Tonight on The Download, stand-up comedians and podcasters, the Sklar Brothers, actor and comedian Adam Pally, and live performance in Studio 435 from Mellow Makes Music. Now, here's your host, a man who came to work shirtless today, Justin Kaufman.
Not true. It's in my back pocket. I like that look. That's my favorite summer look. The t-shirt in the back pocket of the jeans. I only wear jeans. That's a Chicago look. Hey, everybody. Justin Kaufman. It's a download. 7 to 11 tonight. We're in 720 WGN. Ready to rock. Big show lined up. Big week. Excited to be on the air in the Chicagoland area. Reaching several states across the Midwest and into parts of Canada. How about that? Tonight, we will, of course, talk about all things politics. The guys from Touche are here, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. They're coming up at 7:30. Lots to talk about this Benjamin Netanyahu report about that Tehran is essentially continuing their nuclear program in secret, therefore, I guess, voiding the deal, the much ballyhooed deal of the Iran nuclear deal that Obama did and that Trump wanted to get rid of. The question is it, can you, you know, Israeli intelligence and Benjamin Netanyahu, they obviously want more sanctions on Iran. Can we trust that that is accurate information? That's the conversation we'll have. Also, we'll talk, I guess we'll talk comedy. we'll get Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy's take on comedy. What do you think of stand-up comedy in the White House? Guys? Too harsh? I love it. I love America. I love it. All right, tonight we'll leave it to the big guys. We got some great guests coming up at the big table tonight. A new film is out going straight to digital, which is the new craze, Amazon, other places like that. It's called Most Likely to Murder, and it stars Adam Pally and Rachel Bloom. It's directed, co-written by Dan Greger. Dan Greger and Adam Pally in studio tonight at the big table. Adam Pally in sitcoms like The Mindy Kaling Project. He was also in Happy Endings on ABC. Spent some time, grew up in the area. Talking Adam Pally on the show tonight. How great is that? Awesome to have him. Also, the Sklar Brothers. You know them, the identical twins. Stand-up comedians, they do their routines together, of course, but they also had a show on ESPN Classic, Cheap Seats. They have found a way to intertwine sports and comedy and really some of the pioneers of podcasting. Scarborough Country and now Dumb People Town is their podcast. They're doing a live recording of that podcast in Chicago coming up on Friday in Wicker Park. So they'll join us tonight to talk about that and about their careers and their style. Very unique style. It's very improvised, but it's all written. And, you know, to be brothers, identical twins on stage together to finish each other's sentences. If you've seen the Sklar Brothers, you know what I'm talking about. But they are a ton of fun to watch, and it's great to have them on the show tonight. Also, new web series out, Gita's Guide to Moving On. Pooja Mohindra will join us. She is a actress and creator of the web series. Actually got the idea for it. She's a longtime actor in Chicago, and she was in L.A., and she was in a creative writing, I guess, I don't know, workshop, circle, I don't know what you call it, but Issa Rae. And that was the idea was, why don't you make this into a web series? So she has put out a web series. It just debuted, so we're going to talk with Pooja Mohindra coming up here on the show. And also, Mellow Makes Music, hip-hop star right now, rising star. This kid, he's getting a lot of press, and he is going to perform live in Studio 435 tonight. Oh, man, we have all the hot acts. Did you have a good weekend, Pete Zimmerman?
A lovely weekend.
I saw once again, it's kind of becoming annoying, but I see pictures of Pete every weekend pop up all sweaty after finishing a race. You raced again?
Yeah, my wife is training for the marathon, so...
So you're just going along?
I'm just kind of tagging along.
A lot of people, you know, they just make signs. They run the race with them.
My limit is 3 miles, 3.1. Okay. Anything more than
and
that.
And is it like you guys do at the gym? Are you very competitive? Do you try to outrun everybody?
Yeah, I was kind of annoyed at this one because you have to. There's like 3 tiers where you line up, like a corral A, B, and C, mm-hmm. and you have to prove to them that you're worthy of a corral. So, like, I had to send them a time of a previous 5K that I did, so they to prove that I deserve to be in tier A. And then I was really mad because when I get to,
they didn't believe you.
No, they did, but there's tons of like. Power walkers in there as well.
Yeah, that I had to just like I want to be A even though I don't deserve it.
Right. So, right. You know, I'm going to blame my poor performance on the fact that I had to like, you know, try to run
maneuver.
Around everybody. Yeah.
Right.
And speed bumps.
Well, I'm always like the first emotion is, oh, I'm so proud of Pete. He does. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to show off. I get it. You're in shape. The rest of us aren't. I went and saw Infinity War this weekend with my son.
Yeah. Do you have the review all ready to go?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I thought it was good. That's my no spoilers. I thought it was good. That's a great moment in the theater though, where you know, the thing about this film is it's so much anticipation because it's supposed to be the end of the run for the Avengers, and there's all this talk about superheroes dying, mm-hmm. right? And so if you go to any theories online or anything, all the light up the even the trailers were pushing this idea. That's what everybody was taught. My son was hyped up. He's hyped up for that.
Yeah.
Like this is going to be something you never see, mm-hmm. right? And the problem was that the movie knows it. And so every scene, you're like, oh, da, da, yeah. da, da. Oh, not right now. You know, and you're like, okay, well, I guess, all right. And so they got him on one.
Oh,
one
no.
that was essentially just a throwaway fight, not a death, just a fight, just a death and destruction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, all these superheroes get stabbed, but nothing ever happens. And one of them got him, and he audibly started sobbing
no.
in the film. It was so sad. And I was like, and it was a quiet moment, like, right afterwards. And so I heard this, and I'm like, what's an old lady? Who's crying? And I'm like, oh, it's my 10-year-old son. And afterwards, I was ribbing him, and we were talking about it. But he's like, I don't know. He's so cute because he goes, I thought they were all dying. And it was wrong. He was wrong in the scene that they weren't dying. And he said, hey, I can't help it. These are the superheroes I grew up with. Like, you're 10.
That's so good.
It was good. All right. Had a great weekend. Went to Valpo, spent time with my in-laws. My mother-in-law had her 70th birthday. We had a nice party in Maryville at a restaurant. It was a nice time. So, all right, let's get to it tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break, and we'll get to the carryout. So stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here today is top stories. Comedian Michelle Wolf delivered some jokes to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and afterwards, pundits have said that the act crossed the line because she took personal jabs at people in attendance, including Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I know this is going to come up in touche after the news, but what? What are we supposed to be outraged about? You can't make fun of politicians' makeup or what they wear or how they look? Really? Since when? It's so obvious the leader of the free world does not seem to share your concern. The double standard is stunning. Maybe that'll be what Republicans run on in 2018. Hey, we doubled the economy and doubled the standards. Also, Roseanne Barr, seriously? Everyone's into Roseanne now? The same comic that butchered the anthem and spit at the end of it? She's now the spokesperson for mainstream America? And Dennis Miller? He tweeted that Michelle Wolf was a horrible human being? For those jokes? Really? Miller was wisecracking on SNL Weekend Update, and that was his whole... need I say more? He made his whole career on that. What are we doing, people? Make up your mind. Are liberals snowflakes and powder puffs, or are they a moral nihilist that's so mean to everybody? I mean, and this idea that it's the press versus mainstream America. You know what? I'm mainstream America, and I guess I am the press. I didn't even watch Michelle Wolf. I don't care. And I only did after the fact to see what the fuss was about, which at the end of the day seems to be the point here, right? The press, the pundits, the media, the White House, they want to represent our values so bad. But guess what? They don't. They manipulate our values. They set the market for what's acceptable and then ignore their own violations over and over and over. We could divide this country over what we like to eat for breakfast at this point. Let's not get into having columnists and pundits tell us what's funny, because those people think Capital Steps is funny. Dig? Now, next year, get Capital Steps back. Political spoofs are hilarious. I mean, there's more going on, right? There's immigration, there's Iran, there's a looming trade war, maybe, but who cares? Michelle Wolf was mean to the president and CNN and Rachel Maddow. So put two and two together, people. The moral outrage, just masking insecurity. Move on. The heist at Holy Name Cathedral was an inside job. Security guards had a key, stole over 100 grand in collections. Stole from a church? What? Even if you were like, I don't believe in God, don't you at least want to keep the door open just a little bit? Just a crack? You know who I blame this on? Michelle Wolf. So it's possible we have another John Burge situation on our hands with Chicago police. Today, a new trial was granted to a man who was convicted of a gang shooting back in 1995 because he was put away by disgraced Chicago officer Ronaldo Guevara. There are over 50-plus people suggesting that Guevara fabricated evidence to put them away. Wow. This is an interesting case because Guevara was going after gang members and apparently making up whatever he had to do to put him in jail. Obviously, absolutely, stunningly wrong. But an argument could be made that he was essentially trying to keep the streets safe from gangbangers. Supposedly, the gangs feared him. I'm not sure if that affected crime or whatever, but something to think. But now, you know what the bigger issue? Who's going to be on the hook? The city. And who are the investors for the city? Us, the taxpayers. Watch how many of these victims are going to get, and rightfully so, but watch how many they're going to get lawsuits and payouts. All because of what? In weather? Oh, it's so hot out. Remember when it was 40? Those are the best times. When it was 40. Also, full moon last night. And maybe tonight? I don't know. I only saw it because people posted it on Instagram. I think that's going to be our future. There'll be paid social media influencers who are the only ones allowed to go outside. They take all the pictures of all the cool outdoor things. And we're just like. I went outside today. I did not see the full moon. I just saw 18 pictures of it. I was like, oh, it's full moon. In sports, the NFL draft is over and we got a new middle linebacker. It's like GM Ryan Pace knows his job was on the line and another losing season and it's curtain. So he's like, what will make the city like me again? Oh, I know. I'll draft a middle linebacker. Roquan Smith comes to town to be the next Brian Urlacher, although not as bald. Hey-o. It's Hall of Famer, Justin. Come on. And the Bears were able to get a possible starting guard and a possible starting wide receiver in the second round. I mean, what a great draft. I think this was great. I heard Teddy Bruschi today on ESPN projecting that Roquan Smith would be Rookie of the Year. You know the old saying, first you got to play the games? Can we just get rid of that and go ahead and give him the title now? Can we just simulate the whole season like we're playing a game of Madden? No? Doesn't work that way? Cubs are 7-1 with the Brew Crew versus the Brew Crew after a four-game sweep this weekend. Cubs are killing it right now. They're quietly on a bit of a streak and look to be the same Cubs that essentially won the World Series 2 years ago. This while the Nationals and the Dodgers are scuffling a bit. My Cubs, let's keep it going. Big two-game set against the Rockies at Wrigley. Winning right now 1-0, although the Rockies are threatening. Sox beat the Royals over the weekend. Was that a five-game series? I think it was. It was like a first-round playoff series. The biggest storyline is that the Royals catcher had a problem with Tim Anderson celebrating a home run, and it reminded us all about how baseball can be so dumb. Right? I mean, Salvador Perez, have you ever seen a wide receiver get a first down? Have you ever seen a cornerback make a tackle? God forbid, a sack? Or how about a forward make a goal in hockey? Or a dunk before a timeout? That's Celebration City. All sports are celebration now. Come on, your dumb, antiquated rules in baseball. How high did he flip that bat? Did he clap his hands five times before that hit? How many shoelaces did he have on his cleats? The totally stupid part about it is that Anderson was fine and Perez just kept making a deal out of it because it's a thing, I guess, and it could be a brawl and it's really just a measurement contest. I don't know what happened there. The ump made the two players shake hands like they were 11. That's so dumb. NBA playoffs have moved to the second round. So you got Mirotić, Rondo, Etwaun Moore going against Steve Kerr. You got Marco Bellinelli and the Sixers going against the Celtics. You got Kyle Korver and the Cavs versus the Raptors, who don't have any Bulls connection. The Rockets and the Jazz don't either. Seriously? None of these teams could use a Luol Deng right now? Yeah. I'm not watching. And finally tonight, over 90 students who attended a prom at the Shedd Aquarium last weekend got sick. Ooh. I mean, that's one way to remember your high school prom. Probably safer, too. How was your prom? That's the carryout for April 30th, 2018. It's 80 degrees today, so free water cups for everyone. We don't have any water, but we got the cups. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling, Touche! Monday night here, and then at 8 o'clock, we'll have the big table with Adam Pally and Dan Greger talking about the new film, Most Likely to Murder. All that coming up tonight on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, buddy?
The ball boy at Wrigley Field just hosed the Chicago Cubs.
I can't even understand. He thought it was a foul ball, and he tried to make the play, and then he missed the play, hurt the ball.
When clearly it was not foul.
Yeah. Did they call a ground rule double?
They did.
Well, would that help the Cubs?
No. It moved everybody up and allowed the run to...
Maybe Blackman would have scored, or maybe he wouldn't have, but still.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
Another unwritten rule.
Right over by Bartman, too. Good work. Exactly. Good work, dude.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
Touche. It's time for Touche here on 720 WGN, our weekly Monday night segment.
Feels like monthly.
I wish it was Monday.
Well, in April because, you know, of all the White Sox games.
That's right. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in the studio.
Good to be back.
It's hot. It's searing in the studio with conflict.
It is freaking awesome outside. Can I just say that?
Yeah, beautiful. Nice. Finally.
One bipartisan agreement before we get on with the rest of it is that it was finally a beautiful day today.
Yes.
Everything else Chris says is going to be nonsense.
Thank you. Thank you, David.
Let's start with Iran. Iran in the news today because Benjamin Netanyahu comes out and says we have all sorts of intelligence reports to say Iran's been lying this whole time about their nuclear program. Essentially, in a way, to push Trump to get out of the Iran deal.
But hold on. They were lying up to 2015. Netanyahu didn't make comments about what they've been doing since 15.
He said
that, you know, they now have literally hundreds of thousands. Israel's Secret Service, Mossad, has come up with this enormous tranche of documents.
A treasure trove
of documents. And Netanyahu decided to go public with it because by the 12th of May, President Trump has to decide what is the next step for the Iran deal. And this is what has been discussed last week with President Macron, right, and Chancellor Merkel here representing France and Germany. And, you know, Bibi Netanyahu decided to jump in and say, they're lying liars who lie, so keep that in mind and get the heck out of this.
Wouldn't we just assume that the big nations that you just mentioned, Germany, France, and the United States, would already know this?
Yeah, we all knew this. Look, the significance of today that Bibi buried was that his intelligence services did an amazing thing. It wasn't just documents. It was documents. It was like 150 CDs with more documents on it. It was an amazing thing. And Bibi decided, because he had an audience of one and one who only responds visually, that would be President Trump, to have not just a press conference, but there was like a dramatic pulling back of the curtain, and there were things that were covered, and he lifted them up and showed, look, there are CDs here, therefore you should pull out of the treaty.
This is not something to be made fun of.
That's
this
what
is nuclear
did.
Weapons for Iran.
Well, tell and that to Bibi, who put in a slide,
and all it says
is Iran lied.
I deny your point that, quote, we knew all of this. The fact is that our own government, the United States of America, according to a national intelligence estimate published in December of 2008, did not know. And we said we did not know. And so David is rewriting history.
Why are you talking about 2008?
Because that was in the
entire
relevant
point of sanctions was because Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapon. The entire point of the process with the six other countries because Iran was pursuing a nuclear weapon.
David, the point here is that we've got them dead to rights, and it becomes harder and harder for France and Germany, the European Union, world opinion, apart from, say, China and Russia, to deny what Iran is actually intending to do, which
nobody
then implicates the real issues and weaknesses of this, which you can no longer say that Barack Obama negotiated a perfect agreement because
I never said that.
Macron has said we have to strengthen this agreement. And
so is that
why.
What's going
to
happen? Here,
but yeah, he's got John Kerry and Barack Obama were so desperate for an agreement that they never said anything about missile delivery systems for nuclear weapons. Number two, they said nothing with the Iranians about regional troublemaking, which is what Iran has been up to in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and frankly, in a lot of other places around the world, wherever it is, it suits them. Venezuela, for instance.
It's called being a superpower,
okay?
But
number three, there is this sunset provision of 2025, which, as President Trump said today at a brilliant press conference, I thought, with the president of Nigeria, quote, 2025 is tomorrow, okay? So we have this very short, and then the breakout provision, finally. So these are the four areas where they've got to be addressed. The breakout provision is...
You're going to keep filibustering?
This is what we're talking about. The breakout provision that you don't care about, but which is vital to the safety and security of Israel.
One of us views Israel as a personal sanctuary.
Hold on.
That would be me, my friend.
Finish your point, Roland. Finish your point.
Well, we have allowed them to keep their a certain number of high-powered centrifuges.
And your argument is they're exploiting that.
And one of the things that Netanyahu revealed today was the extent to which they had been disguising the centrifuge program and the fact that Kerry and Obama allowed them to keep their centrifuge program.
Up to 2015.
Yes, up to 2015.
And no, 2025.
What they revealed today was that they were lying and cheating up to 2015.
No, hold on. In 2015, we agreed to allow them to keep that facility. We did not shut it down
And in the meantime, Bibi, for all of his bluster today, could not demonstrate that since the agreement has been in effect, that they have been cheating. And he couldn't demonstrate that. Excuse me, that's exactly what he has to. If you want to abrogate it, you got to say they're cheating
somehow.
No
one is talking about abrogating.
You're dealing with stick figures.
Chris,
you're talking... No, hang on. This is important. So 5 weeks ago, the Israeli Defense Forces Chief of Staff said, and I quote, "Right now, the agreement with all its faults is working and is putting off realization of the Iranian nuclear vision by 10 to 15 years. The Israeli security establishment, much of it supports keeping the agreement in place."
No one is saying that we should walk away from the agreement. I don't know where David was last week. I'm the one who was overseas last week. David wasn't listening to the news. Macron and Trump have agreed that they have to build on top with those four provisions that
true.
I just talked about.
I mean, I guess the question, this will play out and we'll move on, but how are they going to do that and get any sort of negotiation with Iran, because they're not going to give up any of those four areas?
We don't know that. That's what people said about North Korea 18 months ago.
And so far, North Korea has given up
nothing. You have no faith in Trump about North Korea, and look at you now.
And so far, North Korea...
You're nominating him for a Nobel Prize, and I think that's beautiful, Justin.
The Nobel Prize goes to Donald Trump. Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling in studio. We're playing Touche. We come back. Let's talk about the more strange rumblings in the White House. Did John Kelly, the chief of staff, call the president an idiot? This is coming out. He denies it.
Everybody in the White House called the president an idiot.
I feel there has to be something more to this story, a story that continues to happen. But we'll talk about it. Dave and Chris are here. It's Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche on 720 WGN. We talk national politics every Monday here on the program. Let's switch to John Kelly, the chief of staff. I guess, in hot water, even though he denies it, and it's a story that continues to happen, and it seems the names interchange, but the NBC News has him saying, calling the president an idiot. Seems like a strange comment for him to say, but and he denies it happened. But what do we make of this story?
So here's the significance of this. You shouldn't really focus on the little details, whether did he call him an idiot, when, how many times, how much of an idiot is the president. You know, all those things are fine. But the significance of this story is that there are sources in the White House who are trying to get John Kelly. And this tends to happen right before somebody gets booted.
Oh my
God. I would give John Kelly less than a month.
Oh, really?
All right, write that down. Write that down.
Yeah,
write it down. You're saying by Memorial Day he's out, because that's a month away.
June 1st.
Yes,
June 1st.
By Memorial Day, June 1st.
There's a week after Memorial Day.
Yes. All right, so here's my two cents. I agree that it is interesting. I mean, first of all, I don't think that NBC has any credibility left at all, but I'm going to give them a
waiting
little bit
for you to tell me the stories they got way wrong about the White House.
The list is too long to mention. Mm-hmm. I think what happens with Kelly is he is a hard-charging, kick-ass, take names and get things done kind of guy. And there are folks who don't like it, and there are folks who will complain about it, and they will pull this kind of stuff. But I believe Kelly's denial, and I believe the fact, from what I've heard, that he spends more time with the president than anybody, and quote, as he said, quote, we both know the story is entirely BS. So I think it's a
weird
dead
story
letter
to make up, though. That's the only thing I have. Maybe
it's not a weird story to make up.
People,
this is all that's been going on since Trump took his oath of office.
I understand
office.
The denials and everything, but it's I don't know. You'd have to have an NBC reporter who's like, I got a thing I'm going to lie about. I just don't buy it.
Here's the problem. The problem is, and the problem for Chris and the problem for Donald Trump and all of the Trumpites like Chris, is that the president calls out fake news, and then Chris calls out fake news, and then it turns out it's true. Like when they were going to fire McMaster.
How many times?
This just happened with McMaster.
How many
where
times?
McMaster, the White House said they have a great relationship, there's no problem, and then a week later McMaster was fired.
How many times? Everybody knew that
it
McMaster
happens
was
over
not
and over and
how
over again.
How many times have they said that Kelly
well, then why did the White House lie about it?
Or that he was about to fire
Nobody
Rosenstein,
said Conway was
or that he was about to fire Mueller. None of this stuff comes through. It's all baloney. Okay, but
right,
and especially
master.
During the period in the run-up to the Korea conversation and the summit, you're not going to say goodbye to General Kelly. You're not going to mix up that team right now. You finally got Bolton in there.
Because that would be crazy. The White House never does crazy things.
You finally got Bolton in there. You finally got Pompeo in there. Pompeo is the only ranking U.S. official who has dealt directly with the leader of North Korea. And this team, this cluster, is absolutely essential to success in these talks, whatever that might be. And success is either going to be he is for real or he is a $3 bill and we're walking out.
Excuse me. The president has defined what success is. And success is complete denuclearization by North Korea, giving up their weapons.
That's not
that
right.
is what the president has said.
That's false.
He tweeted that multiple times.
I want to tell you, success is we're not being taken in again. We won't get fooled again like the Who said or whoever that was.
It was the Who.
And so the success is we are going to test this guy from the moment that we start talking. And if he is for real, then we've got good news. And if he's not for real, we're standing up and we're leaving.
I will say that, you know, if North Korea turns out to do the same thing they've done in the past, I'm not sure that this is a failure on the part of the Trump administration because they got further along the way than any other president in my lifetime.
I disagree.
Maybe disagree, but I just feel like, you know, you're dealing with a very a moving target when it comes to North Korea. They don't seem to follow any logic. So for the Trump administration to get this far is impressive in my mind.
Yeah, but the same thing happened in 2000. The only difference between what happened in 2000 and what happened today or what happened over the weekend was that in 2000, the hug between the North Korean and the South Korean leaders was not at the DMZ, but was in Pyongyang. That was the difference. It was a different photo op. And by the way, the photo op was amazing, and the atmospherics were amazing. All I'm saying is because of North Korea's long history of lying and cheating and taking in the United States and the West, right now I haven't seen anything different.
All right, last
cheat and repeat.
Let's. I mean, we were going to talk a little bit about the tariffs, but the 30-day just breaking news in the last 2 hours that they're going to extend that 30 days to see how it affects Canada, Mexico, and EU.
And here's why that's good.
That's
Trump
good.
Shows he's flexible. Obviously, he's talking to Mexico. He's talking to Canada. He's talking to the EU. You had Merkel in here. You had Macron in here. You're not going to have those guys go home and then, you know, insult them 5 days later with the tariffs.
Actually, it showed he got out over his skis and then had to backtrack, but that's okay.
That is quintessential touche right there. good points by both sides. All right. Michelle Wolf, White House Correspondents' Dinner. I did not see it. No one does. No one goes and watches that thing.
The key thing here is that
I watched it because I knew I was going to talk about it today.
Fact. Yeah, I did too. Many members of the White House Correspondents' Association are calling on the association to apologize. And the current president of the association, until this afternoon at least, was holding a line that she is not going to apologize. I agree with those in the association who say it should apologize to Kellyanne and to Sarah Huckabee, and it should say we're going to do better in the future.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Look, I didn't particularly find her that funny. I thought the first 5 minutes she was pretty funny, and then she started getting really nasty and weirdly sexual. It was not good. This was not even on the level of Colbert, which was biting and made people uncomfortable. What was hysterically funny. I didn't think it was great, but spare me the snowflakes of the right. You people worship at the altar of a president who calls the press the enemy of the people, who said Megyn Kelly had blood coming out of her, whatever, who attacked Rosie O'Donnell for being fat and ugly, who is the ultimate insulter in chief. He is the Don Rickles of presidents. He's an insult comic. And so for you guys to get all righteously indignant because, oh my God, she pointed out that Sarah Sanders is a liar, which she is on a constant daily basis. I'm sorry. I don't think it's that big a deal. And, you know, man up, put on the big boy pants.
It is a roast.
To take David at his word, I would play that tape in every competitive House of Representatives race and every competitive Senate race from here to November. And I can tell you, it's a gift to the Republican Party. And the White House Correspondents Association ought to absolutely repudiate what happened and say this is beyond. David is now saying that the White House Correspondents Association should live by the decency standards of Donald Trump. After he has said all these things
saying
about Donald Trump, no, the White House, they are working together. This was not professional, and this was an affront to everybody who consumes news.
What he's saying is that for the same people who tweeted out they walked out in shame, why aren't they tweeting out shame for the things that the president said?
Right. People are calling on the president to apologize all the time.
You're all a bunch of hypocrites. You're all a bunch of hypocrites.
No, we're not hypocrites.
Wimpy, wussy hypocrites.
All right. The touche bell has rung. The fight is over. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy with us every Monday. Touche, stay with us. Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guests are involved with the new film Most Likely to Murder, which is available now on digital DVD and on demand. The comedy is being billed as a home for the holidays murder mystery. Think Hitchcock's Rear Window, but set on a Thanksgiving weekend. You know, that one where you come home to see all your high school friends. The film proves that you really never can go home again. And if you do, there's probably a murderer living across the street. You know that old saw. The comedy stars Rachel Bloom, Vincent Kartheiser, and Adam Pally. Pally is known from his work on television with sitcoms like Happy Endings and The Mindy Project. He's currently is the executive producer and occasional actor on The President's Show on Comedy Central. Most Likely to Murder is co-written and directed by Dan Greger. Greger is a longtime comedy writer who's worked on How I Met Your Mother and currently on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which also stars Rachel Bloom. This is Greger's debut feature film, and he's used a lot of his friends from his days coming up at UCB in New York and Los Angeles, including star Adam Pally. Both Pally and Greger are in studio tonight.
Hello.
Dan. Hi. Adam, good to see you. Thanks
good
for being
to see
here.
You too.
I love this concept. Let's talk about the murder mystery.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, you know, congratulations on the film. It's great. And I love the when it sets up, you really set it up as, you know, a high school popular kid who gets to go home on that Thanksgiving weekend. Talk about how you get from that to the murder mystery.
You know, the movie in conception like started with like we really love that night, right? The night before Thanksgiving where everyone's back in town and you all go to the local bar that you probably you got in before with a fake ID because they didn't really care. It was sort of Facebook before Facebook,
right?
Where you're just like, oh man, that's what happened to that guy, and like, oh, she's pregnant now, oh man. And so we, that sort of moment where you're really like inundated with nostalgia, and often you are desperate to like get back to it, but that also that realization that you'll never get it back. There is no going back, like right. You said. And so we really wanted to explore that emotion, but we sort of realized there's probably enough stories about, like, you know, 30-something white guys being like, I'm not young anymore, that we wanted to put a twist on it, right, and give it some more stakes and energy.
We'll stay with the coming home, going back to your hometown, your high school. Adam, for you, is any of it feel nostalgic? Any of it feel relatable? The idea of coming back to town feeling like you're going to mop up and instead kind of being pushed aside?
No, not really. I mean, I, not on that level. I think to me, you know, I moved around a lot as a kid, so I never had like a legit like hometown love affair. Like I never, you know, I was always kind of like moving. But what is relatable is the idea of like when you leave high school, you're creating a new kind of, it's like, now this is my new self. And then you do it again when you leave college. And then, you know, there's like often times in your life where you're like, I'm starting anew.
Right, right.
And it was interesting to me to play a character that kind of like never did that and so expected no one else to do that. And so that's kind of, that was the most relatable thing to me.
It is relatable, Dan, and just in the way that everyone who's going to watch the film is going to understand the concept of coming back to Thanksgiving weekend at home. What I love about it is there seems to be a lot of change. Mm-hmm. Everybody around is changing. The character of Billy doesn't. That's the comedy. But this concept that, yeah, people are different than when they were 18 to when they're 35,
yeah,
and what have you.
Yeah, that was a really important part for us, is that, you know, especially looking at the kids that maybe growing up were more outcasts, that were put upon, and you maybe didn't have it so easy. And only as an adult do you realize, oh, those were probably the kids most in need of, like, sympathy and decency, because they probably had, like, the hardest home life and actual they were dealing with, whereas, like, you know, I was just getting drunk in high school and it was super easy.
We should ask you to, are we allowed to curse?
You're not, but that's okay. Right, okay. We'll get so it in post.
Did I curse?
You did again.
I don't even know when I curse.
This on the whole
I don't even know when it comes out of my mouth.
Dan cannot. It's crazy. It's like he's an old-timey sailor.
I'm never
insane.
Around children.
I've never seen anything like it. It's like no awareness.
Truly,
Dan curses like I smoke weed. Everywhere.
I don't even know.
Doesn't
what,
matter where.
It doesn't
right?
matter where.
Where did I curse just there? I honestly, I couldn't.
You didn't
say.
Hear that?
I couldn't even tell you.
I was tempted
I
to hit your cough button. You know, I think you might have said it twice.
What did I say?
It's only one time. Only
right.
one
what
time.
Did I say?
Right. It doesn't.
Oh
matter.
Yeah, you can't repeat.
We're
it.
Mature enough to not care.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
That's the thing.
Okay.
We're intelligent.
But cursing is.
Got it. Got
is
it.
Is permitted
not,
or not
permitted.
Permitted?
It's not permitted.
Not permitted. I'm not trying to, I promise.
He's going
to
do it again. He's going to do it again. It'll happen 15 minutes from now. We will have all forgotten
forget this conversation.
And he will do it again.
I have no short-term memory. I don't know what we were talking about.
Well, let's go.
Imagine being directed by this guy.
I have a whole line of questioning about improv. You guys have spent a lot of time on stage in improv and learned a lot about the techniques, and how much of it do you expect to be a part of your films? How much does improv play into what we see in Most Likely to Murder?
On a broad level, the ethos of improv, of like supportive collaboration, is everything. You know, that I try to have a set that's very much like, go with the best idea. Everyone's bringing something to the table. Let's keep building this together. And then once we get on set, it's a weird balance, because on a low budget movie, you are these days are tight. You
right,
do
right.
not have a lot of time to mess around. I didn't say the other way to say mess around, which I was about to.
See?
I caught myself.
Much quicker.
Yeah, exactly. I'm proud of myself right now. So, you know, there isn't as much improv as I would like to do, because we have some of the best improvisers in the world in this movie, because ultimately, you know, these things are going to get cut. But we still did have a ton of improv. And, you know, usually the way it goes is like you get it right, you get it once for safety, and then you play around.
But you have to be organized. That's
yeah.
the big difference, right?
This yes.
isn't the
this
group
isn't,
getting together at night and let's
right.
just see where it heads.
And
you
this,
have
isn't,
to be
this isn't Judd Apatow, who has, you know, months and months to overshoot like crazy and can improvise everything a dozen different ways. This is, we were shooting like 7-8 pages a day, which is a ton of work.
Yeah, right.
And so we had to, you know, really target where we could sort of bifurcate our lines and our concepts.
How much did you rely on what you've learned in your improv life, Adam?
Well, I think what I've learned in my improv life is probably the number one kind of, as Dan was saying, thing that I try to all the things that I've learned about being an improviser on stage, I try to apply to my life, because they're, without being too like hippie-ish about it, you know, the similar thing about improv and life is that you don't know what's going to happen next. So right. You're living every moment of every day with no idea what's going to happen next, but you think you do, so you can kind of like anticipate. And that's really all improv is just kind of like assuming something and anticipating it and
being
kind
prepared,
of
right?
Being right. prepared in right. that in that way. So it's kind of just like walking into the improvisation, if you know what I mean, yeah. is like the, that's kind of how I hope to be, is that I just like walk into it. So I always use that stuff, like I think at its core is like the way you want to feel. And I think as an actor, you try to even use those rules of improv in when you're acting. So it's like small things like make a choice, you know, like everything you do as an actor, you can make a choice. The way this guy picks right. up the coffee, the way that I
yeah,
turn
he had
to Dan,
he has a great like, moment in the movie where he's going to an old friend's house and he's got a knock on the door. But Pally just did a great job of improvising. Like, well, he's knocking on the door of a friend that like he looks down on already, is like already bothered to be spending time with him, and so he knocks like endlessly and aggressively, like, "Where are you? Where are you?"
And I dump the scooter like right on the
right,
yard.
Yeah. It's got just
like
I noticed that, yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
so like stuff like that is like. It's improvising. You're in the moment, like deciding that you're in this character, you're gonna act this way. So you're always kind of doing that stuff. And I think that's where I take that training from. And then like other yeah. there's so many little things that I like picked up along the way that I apply to every like another thing I said to Dan this morning was a teacher along the way told me this sentence, like, if this then what? It was like such a small little like improv-y nerdy thing, but that is like such a key. Because then you start thinking like, well, if I'm this, I do this, and I do this, and I do this, and that's kind of the way that you act, you know?
It's amazing to think that, too, because when you watch the character of Billy in this film, you do see a lot of choices being made, choices that define who the character is, and that could be anything from, like you said, like dumping the scooter on the lawn, the way he knocked the door, or even how he acts when he's drunk.
Yeah.
Everything about it that may not necessarily be in the script.
Yeah.
It may not necessarily mm-hmm. be direct notes yeah. from Dan, but it's something that you bring to the character because you're living that character.
And I think those are the best performances. I think from seeing myself, like, that's where I'm the best, is when I'm able to be, like, fluidly making choices in everything. Especially, like, I did a play this year, and it was the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And that was very much, like, you're saying the same exact words every night, like to the period and the comma. Like, and so what you have to do is figure out ways to improvise every night for yourself in that character. And that is, to me, I was getting the same rush from doing that as I was from going out on stage with nothing and getting something. And so that, and I feel the same way when we do big movies and there's like $1 billion on the line and they're like, jump from the second floor window, and you're like, what if I do it like this? You know, like, it's the same thing.
Same
to
idea.
Me. Yeah.
To Pally's real credit, you know, there's a difference in the type of improvising actors do on set. There's great improvisers who show up on set and will do the lines and then riff in whatever direction's funny, right? That makes them laugh. It makes even the set crack up. The crew laughs. That's always like right. this like weird sort of fool's gold, because like when the crew is laughing, you're like, well, I know this is really fun, but in a very plot-driven movie, is it on story? And Pally's real skill is that he improvises within good. Story. And so you never, like, our first cut of this movie was 2 hours and 20 minutes. Nobody wants to see that movie. And that's because
you actually do.
You know,
do
I love it. I fought tooth and nail to keep it all in. But, you know, that's because that's all that great improv is so funny and I love it. But eventually you're like, oh, I realize that the story is sort of falling away and we need the plot to really fly.
Dan Greger is the director. Adam Pally is one of the stars of the film Most Likely to Murder, which is available on digital DVD and on demand. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Dan Greger and Adam Pally. Dan Greger, the co-writer and director of the film Most Likely to Murder. And Adam Pally is the star. You can find it on right now. It's released on digital, DVD, and on demand. Talk about this, the concept of skipping the theaters. I mean, this is something that you're seeing more and more films do, and just skip theatrical entirely. And it's not the old way where it was maybe a Steven yeah. Seagal movie we're talking about.
Yeah, I was saying before, yeah, it's not the type of movie that goes straight to demand. This is not the same thing as Liam Neeson in front of a bunch of fire. Like, this is
a bad Photoshop.
Yeah. And then in the corner is like Andy Garcia
and a wolf.
And then the other corner is a wolf. Yeah. And then Diane Lane. We made this movie through a digital department of Lionsgate, which is a studio. And we kind of, I don't know, this is how we watch movies. You know,
yeah.
We watch movies.
I mean, like, I think the surreal of it is that, like, there's just this difference between being a big Marvel movie and then being a movie that is really meant to be, you know, hang out with your friends, watch a movie on a Friday night, like in your house with your, you know,
with wine,
Netflix and chill kind of movie.
Yeah.
And obviously, with these streaming networks now, like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, even, you're finding different ways to actually be able to produce these films and get and distribute them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that change the way as you both entertainers and artists and writers and actors see the world that you live in? I mean, is there opportunities now that were never there before?
Yeah. I mean, it's all a give and take. There are way more opportunities for writers and actors to work and to grow through the industry than ever before, just because there's more stuff shooting than ever before, because there's more outlets than ever before. However, the compensation on that is sometimes not even enough to live off of for a lot of these places.
You need to work a lot more.
So it's not
the one job every couple of years.
Right.
It's like, I'm going to have to do three or four things right now and really stack stuff. And honestly, as creators, it's kind of more satisfying anyway. You're making more things, and you're in it more. And
Dan doesn't have children, so as soon as he has a kid, and he realizes that his brain is now gone and he can't think of any good ideas, he will want to make money off the things that he did in the past.
You know, I'm going to reboot this movie.
Both of you guys spent time in New York in the improv scene there in UCB, which is obviously has roots in Chicago, went to New York. But I love it because you guys are early adapters in a way, because now you think of UCB both in LA and New York, and you guys both still perform, but man, it's a whole different, it's a university as opposed to a small, it used to be a laundry dry cleaner. So talk about what it means that you guys were involved with UCB when you were in the early 2000s and how that helps you in your careers now.
I mean, the biggest thing for me was like when I got up at UCB, I started, my sketch group had a weekly show. We had an hour to ourselves every week for a year to do whatever. We put up our best of, we refined our best of sketches, we put up new stuff every week, we made a bunch of short films, and just having that, truly that space to grow and test yourself and keep honing and refining is, that's it. That's the 10,000 hours. That's how you get it, that you become an expert in something and actually have it in your bones about like what works, what doesn't work, by just doing it over and over and over again. And I just know that like that's the hardest thing about these big mega improv theaters now, that to get that type of stage time would take years and years at this point. It would take much longer to get that level of experience.
And there is something not only about the discipline of being able to get the stage time and learn and make mistakes, but there's also something about the relationships formed by doing that and being in your sketch group and doing that every week for years. You're finding relationships, and those relationships are, I would assume, what you're relying on as you move forward in your career.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in the beginning, for sure, they are the most important, because they are the like-minded people who speak your language. And I think then they can continue to be valuable, but I think that it is a responsibility of the improviser and the entertainer to grow and learn how to work outside of that.
That's a really good point, because there's a lot of times that people will be that don't make that jump or don't have the skills to be able to get outside of the ensemble. And you see that.
And sometimes just the, I don't know a better way to say it, but like just the bravery to take that jump.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy. I mean, like it's great to have a home base and you're performing every week, you're getting laughs every week, but it's really important to step outside your comfort zone.
It's one of the things that Dan and I as kids at the theater would talk about this quite a bit, because it was just something that we both struggled with a lot. But it's like once we're at an improv theater and there's a community and it's you know really supportive and all that stuff, but you are an actor and you are a writer, and you have to own that, and you have to be able to work with other actors and other writers and other directors. And you can't just be this ethereal guy at a theater. I mean, you can, but like that's not what we wanted.
Right. I mean, I remember my sketch group coming up, so Donald Glover was in our sketch group, and obviously he was quite talented. And it was one of those things when he broke off because he started being super successful, there was a moment I was like, but we were going to be a sketch group together forever. And like, it obviously took me a moment to realize like, wait, this guy's an unstoppable force. He's going to be a big star. And being on the other side of that realization where it was like, oh wait, no, like he doesn't owe anyone anything other than his own success.
Yeah. And so it filters through you, but it also filters through, it's like everyone around you doesn't know anybody anything, but you also are not owed anything.
Right.
And I think that sometimes that's a tough lesson. And I forget it often. And I, you know, it's something I try to rely on the most, which is something you really have to step outside of that theater to realize.
Right. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break for the news, and we'll continue the conversation.
Adam, wait, they're doing the news on this show?
They do news, yes.
They break this up with the news.
The news is... Adam Valley, Chance
for the news. Who's Rob Martino will be doing this.
Yeah,
this
no, trust me. That's it. The news is everything. This is just, this is filler. The new film is Most Likely to Murder. It is available right now on digital DVD and on demand. We'll take a quick break, get the news, come back, and continue the conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests in studio tonight are the co-creators, the directors, the actors, the stars of the new film Most Likely to Murder, which is now available on digital, DVD, on demand. In studio, Dan Greger and Adam Pally. Both longtime improvisers and actors. You've seen them in different sitcoms and writing, and both in front of the camera, and executive producer of The President's Show on Comedy Central. As we were talking about before, about improv and how the world works, that Donald Glover story is great because both of you guys had a lot of success, but I would assume that, you know, it's all supportive at one point, but when you start to get the audition and you start to make that break and get a chance to be on Birbiglia's film, you know, like being on Saturday Night Live or you know, How the Others Feel.
Yeah, I was in that movie.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, so but the idea.
Curmudgeonly SNL, right?
Yeah, I was Colin Jost.
So that concept is one that, like you said, bandied about the improv theaters for a long time. This idea of when other people have success, especially have to break out of the ensemble. How do you guys deal with that? Is that something you even think about as actors and directors?
You know, honestly, like, I really think Dan will back me up on this. I never had that with other people. I never...
Pally was the most confident person in the world, so I don't think... Pally was ever afraid of being left behind.
I don't know about that, but I never had that. Like, when I see a friend succeed, I really only feel positive for the friend, and if anything in myself, it makes me, like,
motivates me. Yeah, right.
I never... Even, like, movies I've lost or things that, like, I never... Rarely am I like, that guy, yeah, like, yeah, right, what? Right, like, right. I never... feel that because I don't know. My dad taught me a long time ago that if this is what you're doing, then this is what you're doing, and your journey is going to be like a roller coaster. So just because you're at the bottom of it and a friend of yours is at the top doesn't mean that he did something to you or that, you know, it's like...
That's a very Zen way.
Pally, I can't disagree with you more.
but that's my own. But that's my own.
I love that you're saying that.
There's other.
I felt I was a wreck of nerves and fear constantly. You know, and there is a separation between like a bitter animosity, jealousy, where it's just like that guy for
I told you it was going to happen.
That guy for succeeding.
I told you it was going to happen. And it happened
almost to the minute
of when I said it was going to happen, happened.
Well,
you guys are working together way too long.
I know, my schedule.
Yeah,
but
here's this.
Yeah,
it'll happen again,
guys. I make this solemn vow that I will not curse a single time.
Now he wants to do it.
Yeah.
He's got to finish it. He's got a slight OCD. He's going to want to get a third
now
one.
It's right
at
the end.
So if we don't get it, I know he's going to bail me out at the end and just do it.
That's the blackout line.
Comedy minds in studio.
Our very good mutual friend, Gil O'Ziri, who's a brilliant performer.
Maybe the funniest person I've ever met.
I will always remember a conversation we had when we were coming up. And we were friends with all these great, funny people at UCB. And he said... He just said, like, in this very, like, self-defeated way, he was like, what are the odds that of all the people here that, like, we're all going to, like, work and be successful? It's like maybe, like, 1, 2, 3 people. And you think we're in the 3 funniest people here? And it really broke my heart because I was like, well, no, I'm not, like, in the top 3 out of, like, the 300 people here. And but he was wrong. That's the thing that was so wonderful about it. Everyone who stuck it out, who worked really hard and kept developing themselves, like, did find a really wonderful career for themselves in a place and really made great, like, comedy.
As someone who's I'm an astute observer of it because I know a lot of the comedians who are coming up through from time being in comedy, that there are generations. And you will see generations like your generation that will just have such success, and you'll see shows on Comedy Central, or you'll see shows that are in, you know, or movies like this, where you start to see a group of comedians start to have, over and over, they have success. And there may be roller coaster in there in their personal careers, but they're making the greatest stuff. When you go and see what's happening with Broad City, or you're seeing shows out of New, other shows, present shows, a great example.
Mm-hmm.
You recognize, you know, this is a group of people who performed and came up together. They've evolved together on bare bone stages on Wednesday night shows at 11:30 at night, and it shows. And it's there's something beautiful about the idea that the time has been put in. It's not an overnight success. The time has been put in for you guys to have success.
That was a very big part of this movie for us, was that, you know, Pally and my writing partner, Doug Mand, were roommates in New York. And when I graduated college, I couldn't bring myself to move home, and I moved onto their couch. And we were just broke and trying to make comedy. And this movie is in so many ways what we were trying to put together for the last decade plus, that just we know that we can do this together, and we put all the work in to do all the sketches, all the improv, and then find sort of our career success outside of it, and then to come back and be able to have something that had this enormous, you know, groundwork between my Rachel Bloom, who was in the same sketch group that I was after I left, and Pally and Doug, and to be able to like have this sort of family come back together and create something that we're immensely proud of is a dream, and so satisfying.
When you look at your careers and you think about it and you try to take the view as you're in the middle of it, is this what you guys said? Is this why you moved to New York? Is this why you set up shop to do comedy, is to get in the opportunity to work together and to do films like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is why we left our day jobs. Well, I moved back to New York to do comedy, to figure out how I was going to do comedy. And very instantly, I met Dan and Doug and realized that the way you do comedy is you collaborate. And so, like Dan was saying, this is the lesson we learned from that, is that every part of your day and job can be a collaboration, and that will make a better day.
And I remember I started at UCB. I took my level one class or level two class, and I was so enamored with it. And I went home that summer. I was still in college, and I went home that summer to my high school friends, and I was like, we need to start a sketch group. And I like forced all of my high school friends to like be in a sketch group with me, and none of them cared. None of them were like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? I really just force of will like made them spend every like Thursday night with me doing improv, and they'd never like me trying to reteach them my level one lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And we put up a show, and it was like very bad. And I realized, I was like, oh, I need to cultivate like an actual group of people that want to do this. Right. That this everyone is sort of like seeing the mountain in the distance, and we're all walking towards the same thing.
For people who might be listening who haven't made that jump, or might be someone who's like, I want to do what you guys do. I want to be able to make a movie like Most Likely to Murder. I don't want to say advice, but when the idea of jumping, saying, I don't want to do this day job anymore, I want to find these like-minded people. What do you recommend? What are some of the lessons you guys learned early on that you would either say, don't repeat, or
I mean, again, like I go back to my dad who taught me a lot of this stuff, because he was an actor for a lot of my childhood and then decided he didn't want to do it anymore. So he had a lot of advice and insight to me. And one of the things he taught me early on was, again, if this is what you're doing, then this is what you're doing. So my parents never made me have a fallback plan or anything like that. They just demanded that I do it every day, and and that this is what I was going to do. And so once you do that, and I remember when Dan's one of the few people I know that was also a great executive in comedy.
I got out of college and I got a job in comedy development at HBO. That was my first job, and it was a good education.
Yeah.
I learned about how things actually get made. But I mean, it really was. I was too stupid to realize how hard it is to make a living at like being an artist. And so we sold a pilot for, I mean, maybe
pennies.
Nothing. And we split it three ways with Doug. And so we didn't really make any money. But the day that the contract closed, I walked into that office and I was like, I quit. I'm out of here. And only after I did that did I realize, wait a minute, like I can only pay my rent for like another month.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing. But thankfully, I'd painted myself into a corner that I was at the point where I was like, well, I have to make this work. I have no other options.
And I think that's my biggest advice is like, you know that you have no other options when you know, like, it would kill you to do anything else,
right?
And so when you're doing that, then you'll do it, you'll figure it out. For me, I have no other skills. I can't do anything.
Oh, I constantly think there's so many times in my life where I've stopped and been like, I'm trapped. There's no other option but to keep doing this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I can't. I'm so without skill.
Yeah.
I'm unhirable.
Can't do anything. Can't put together a toy. I can't grocery shop.
You should see me try to multiply like 7 times 8.
Oh, I can't pay a check.
Oh,
forget
yeah.
it. Paying
forget
a check it. Is a nightmare. That is nightmare time for me.
I've had a couple of people in Broadway stars. This is a question that they always react to, and I wonder the same with actors and writers. But the Broadway stars will get a chance to be in Hamilton or something big, and they're on top of the world, and they recognize that's a 6-month gig,
yeah.
and they're back to auditioning with 400 people to try and get it again,
mm-hmm.
and it's always, you know, a crapshoot if they're going to get
yeah.
it. For you guys, do you like that lifestyle? Do you like the lifestyle that you could be right now?
Absolutely not. No. It's terrible.
I'll say that's actually the biggest advice that whenever anyone asks me, I give is the fundamental skill to succeeding is getting comfortable with failing. Understanding that the amount of rejection that we receive on a daily basis is unlike any other profession that anyone goes through. And I think that's actually the reason that most people give up on keep doing this, because, you know, even...
Yeah, look
even
at my mentions.
Well, you know. But, like, even in this movie, the amount of times that I got a note from someone that said, don't do that, or we can't do that, or for any number of reasons, it's just not going to happen, let alone the actual negative reactions you get.
I mean, acting is all being rejected. That's the whole craft of acting is being rejected. You go out and you do it one way, and someone's like, do it this way. And the worst actors are the ones that go, no.
Yeah.
I was right. You know, like, you have to take the note and go, okay, I'll change what I was doing. And so that's every second of our day.
It's baked into it, right?
Yeah, it's like we're baked. Rejection is part of what we do, and you got to just get back up.
And I think it's the type of rejection that almost everyone else can't even comprehend, the amount of rejection that you get every day, all the time, from every different angle. And the thing that you're seeing up on a screen is the sliver of your life. And so it really is just learning to go with it.
To be comfortable with that. Yeah.
Dan Greger is the co-writer and director of Most Likely to Murder, which is now available on digital, DVD, and on demand. He's currently also a writer on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Adam Pally, the star of the film, who, of course, we've seen in sitcoms like Happy Endings and The Mindy Project. He's also the executive producer on The President's Show on Comedy Central. You guys, I can't thank you enough for coming in, talking shop, and being my guest tonight.
Thank you,
man. This was so fun.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this weekend, legendary photographer Art Shea passed away at the age of 96. To say that Art Shea took pictures is a huge understatement. Art Shea captured history. He lived in an extraordinary life behind the lens. The image he captured of Nelson Algren, Division Street, Chicago, wars, protests, dignitaries, their historical record. In a way, Art Shea was our society's staff photographer. He started taking pictures at the age of 14, but it wasn't until World War II where he knew he had something special. He was a navigator on bombing runs, and he was able to capture a harrowing scene of a plane crash and the wreckage and the chaos that ensued. He sold those pictures to Look magazine. And after he left the service, he sold more pictures to places like Look, Life magazine, and Sports Illustrated, just to name a few. He took pictures of people. That was his specialty. He was able to let his lens capture people living in despair on Division Street in the 50s. He was able to capture people protesting against war and government in the 60s. He was able to capture people, candid shots of Muhammad Ali and Elizabeth Taylor. His photos, accompanied by the words of his friend Nelson Algren, are breathtaking. His photos at the 1968 Democratic National Convention are the photos of record for an undeniable moment in history. And his photos of his wife, who he lost to cancer in 2012, are mesmerizing. I had a chance to interview Art on a number of occasions. He was a special human being. It was a year ago, almost to this day, that Art came on this very show, sat at the big table, to talk about his craft and his Lifetime Achievement Award that he just received. In this clip, Art gives us a little insight to what makes a good photo, and of course, a life lived through the lens.
I have this camera I carry with me, and it happens to be a small Canon that does everything. And I like to carry a camera with me. It's sort of like a notebook. And I use it exactly as you would use a notebook, and it's my life, and I love it. A good photograph is a biography of the moment. It's very difficult with the camera as a mere instrument, or even as the pen, to characterize a person on a chance or first-time meeting. I don't think there's any great trick to it. It's the trick of observation. We all have an eye, and we use it in various ways. I think I'm lucky to have had the kind of eye that recognizes life as it really is, the kind of eye that Algren had, for example, my friend. We used to wander around the city, or we did for about 9 years, and I did a body of work on Algren, and I even did the famous nude picture of his girlfriend, yep. Simone de Beauvoir, for which I'm still either praised or pilloried, depending on your point of view. And
this photo is so iconic. This is the one where she's in the bathroom, and she's looking in the mirror, and it's in an apartment, an old Chicago. This is the Chicago apartment,
yeah,
right?
It's almost a $10 a month apartment.
Yeah, it's such a striking photo that I can see crisp in my mind right now. Yeah. It's one of the most famous photos of all time.
Actually, Sandro, who did this fine book with the actor Malkovich on various quintessential pictures of the last 2 decades, he set that whole scene up at his studio on Huron Street and did a very fine picture. Of course, Malkovich ain't no Simone, but he certainly has a much bigger rear end. And it was a lot of fun. The only editors I had a problem with were the French editors of Paris Match and other French magazines. It made the cover of several magazines in Paris, and I had an exhibition there in 07, and my wife, who is since deceased, she thought it was really amazing. Mm-hmm. But the only thing the French editors were really persistent about on questioning was whether I had slept with her.
Really?
Well, I mean, after all, she was
naked,
the girlfriend of a best friend of mine, and who had helped arrange the picture, and I wouldn't have shown my appreciation in any way by doing such a terrible deed. I spoke around it, and I ended up quoting, of all people, St. Augustine, as I often do. He said, I'm ready for reform, but not just yet. Of course, he was talking to God. I don't know who I was talking to.
That's photographer Art Shea, who was on this program about a year ago to this date. Art Shea died this weekend at the age of 96. I'm proud to have known Mr. Shea and to call him my friend. His work will live on forever. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, the Sklar brothers join us. Pooja Mohindra talks about her new web series, Gita's Guide to Moving On. And we'll have Studio 435 with a live performance from Mellow Makes Music. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guests are coming to the North Bar for 2 stand-up shows and a live recording of one of their podcasts, Chicago Make Way, for the Sklar Brothers.
So now that we have kids, we're looking back at the way our parents raised us. It's just the two of us, and they did a great job raising us. But one thing we're realizing looking back is that our father always had a job.
He did.
Which baffles us today because we're wondering why he decided to raise us as if we were the poorest family in America.
Yeah, like...
We were Dust Bowl migrant workers.
Characters in the Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah. Can we go to Disneyland? Keep picking the grapes.
I don't know if they pick grapes in that book.
Our dad actually had us believing we could be evicted from a house that we owned outright.
We owned the house.
How did he do it?
No landlord. He had us doing it so he would get us to stop doing things he didn't want us to do.
Exactly, right. We'd be upstairs playing Nerf hoop, jumping, and he'd just yell at the floor, which was our floor, his ceiling, and be like, keep jumping up there. They'll take it away.
They'll take the
All of this is going to be gone.
I'll get the suitcases. You should, we're going to be right living there. Out of the suitcases now because they had to play Nerf hoop.
Yeah, you know a great place you can play Nerf hoop? The bus station. That's where we're going to be living now.
Jason and Randy Sklar are best known for their stand-up, performing all around the country. They've produced 4 comedy albums and specials for both Comedy Central and Netflix, and Stars coming up here. They also had their own ESPN classic show called Cheap Seats. And, of course, they're very well known for their wildly popular podcast, Sklarboro Country, which they just retired, and they have a new podcast, Dumb People Town. Got a lot to talk about with these guys. The Sklar Brothers are a force, and like I said, will be on stage Friday at North Bar in Wicker Park with 2 stand-up shows and a live taping of their Dumb People Town podcast. But first, they're here with us tonight. Randy and Jason Sklar, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you so much for having us. We love Chicago so much. Being from the Midwest ourselves, it is literally one of our favorite cities to come to. And you mentioned our Stars stand-up special, which will premiere tomorrow. It'll be available on the Stars app. And then Wednesday night, it'll be airing on Stars at, I believe, 10, maybe 9 Central.
And that's from the show you guys did last year.
At Lincoln Hall. When you're given a choice when you do a stand-up special to record it wherever you want, and we chose Chicago mainly because we've always had great shows in Chicago. Chicago audiences get comedy, but they're not so uptight that they don't let you go for stuff, and yet at the same time, they're there to have fun, and we've always just had great shows there.
Chicago obviously has a very robust stand-up comedy community, and it also has spaces to do shows, to tour. When you come here, where do you guys usually play? And because Lincoln Hall is a place that is mostly music, and North Bar as well is starting to get into comedy, talk about the kind of venue you like to play when you come to a city like Chicago.
Well, there for many years, we played over on Broadway. I think this is in Lincoln Park. We did the Lakeshore Theater, which was amazing, and that was a great venue for comedy. And then that one time we did the Main Stage Theater, which is up by Loyola, and that was really cool. It seemed like that was a great sort of a space. And then we started doing Up, the club, the comedy club above Second City, which was great. And now we're doing North Bar because we have a relationship with Jim Weber, who runs North Bar, who's really starting to get phenomenal acts in to create like a certain comedy scene there. And we thought, you know, we play bigger venues, but it's kind of fun to maybe do a few shows in one night, pack them in. The shows are selling really well. I don't know if there's a ton of tickets left, so if you're interested in going, you definitely should go. We have a great guest for our live podcast. We've got part of, I guess, sketch and improv royalty in Chicago, Dave Pasquese. He's unbelievable. He'll be our guest, and Dan Van Kirk's coming with us, who's so wonderful, and he'll be doing stand-up with us. And we just kind of want to help generate new comedy venues in Chicago, and Jim Weber has a great one at North Bar.
Yeah, I love it, too. Wicker Park needs more of that. Talk about your style, you guys. Watching all of your clips and the specials, you guys have definitely been able to rely on the communication of brothers, of course, but there is something great that kind of hails back to the past of being able to jump in on each other's sentences, but also create something new. Talk about crafting a duo-style stand-up show like you guys do with the Sklar Brothers.
It's a great point. It's a little bit different, you know, than, you know, you come up with one person can come up with a premise, this happened to me, and then that's it. We kind of have to go through another layer of like, how can we both sort of interact with what's going on here? If it's a story that just affects me, Randy, well, how does Jason feel about it? And Jason can be like the audience commenting on it. Or if it's something we both experienced, do we jump into like a sketch immediately? A lot of our stuff, instead of like giving examples that comedians would give, we then jump into an act out of acting out what exactly, you know, we're trying to say. And, you know, being twins and being able to listen to each other and sort of almost like there's a little bit of improv kind of woven in through what we do because we want to keep it exciting. It's a mix of stand-up, sketch and improv that kind of people are seeing real moments on stage, and that's what we want to try and give them, and something different than if it were just one person standing up there. That's what we've been working on.
And it uses, but it uses what I love about it is it may not be improvised, meaning you may know the lines that you'll do, but it uses a lot of the tenets, the philosophy behind improv, the yes and for both of you guys, and being able to pick up and almost go with what the other brother is saying. There's something great about that because it does feel like it's on the spot.
You know what? Thank you for noticing that. Yeah, that was a conscious decision when we started out because a lot of people wanted to push us into characters and archetypes and having tension with each other, like a lot of classic comedy teams had. You think about the Smothers Brothers, probably the most famous other brother duo, but, you know, Martin and Lewis and Abbott and Costello and all the famous comedy teams usually had very different personalities, and one guy was the straight man, the other was the funny man, and the straight guy was trying to rein in the funny man all the time, and that... We are huge fans of that, but we said it's already been done. Maybe we can have a different approach. Maybe we can have a postmodern approach to the comedy team and create something different where, you know, we were very influenced by, like, the Beastie Boys. That was hugely influential to us. We thought they were talented. We thought they were funny. They crisscrossed with each other. They added and they supported what each other said. And at the same time, they overlapped, but they never stepped on each other. And there was something really cool with that delivery that affected us a lot. And I think subconsciously we found a way to kind of weave that style into what we do.
Yeah. You know, another way that you guys have been ultra successful, obviously on stage and being able to have specials on networks like Starz coming up this week, but also Comedy Central and Netflix, has been podcasts. You have been at the forefront, if not the pioneers, of comics with podcasts. Now it feels like anyone who's going to go to Los Angeles to get into Hollywood, the agent tells them you got to have a reel and you have to have a podcast. That's like the new thing, a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Talk about how you deal with competition, people doing the same thing, and now this glut of podcasts, especially since you guys are at the forefront.
You know, it's so funny. I think back to the beginning when we were thinking about doing a podcast. We're talking a decade ago, and guys like Chris Hardwick and Jimmy Pardo, a great Chicago comedian, and, you know, Doug Benson, these are all people who have major podcasts that actually predated when we started. They kind of talked about how great it was to have this sort of weekly mouthpiece to do kind of what you wanted to do. And I think at the beginning, everybody sort of interviewed people, and we all kind of interviewed whoever we could get and get the biggest guests that you could. And then sort of Maron's podcast came along, and, you know, once he got Obama, we were like, well, no one's going to get bigger than that.
Yeah.
And these are interesting, but I think you sort of podcast grew out of that initial phase, and it was like, well, you have to have an angle on what you're doing. And the podcast we'll be doing at North Bar is a podcast called Dumb People Town, and it actually takes an idea that we all believe that the world is getting dumber. I mean, we believe that it's happening right now as we speak. There's a naked guy probably in Tampa with a machete who's going to the bathroom in someone's pool that isn't his. I haven't read the news, but I'm telling you that's probably happening.
Right.
And so understanding that premise, we say, okay, well, what's our recourse? There are all these crazy local news stories that you see in your news feed, or you're looking on Yahoo News or AOL News or wherever. How do we then take that and make that funny? So we said, okay, what if we did a show where our fans sent us in the stories, and then we, and along with Dan Van Kirk, who will be with us at the North Bar on Friday night, the
break
three of
them
us
down.
Break them down, and it actually is very cathartic because we get to make fun of the decisions that, you know, people in this country make and just have a blast trying to break it down and create comedy in the ways of you described before, almost like improv ways, and the stories themselves provide that information. And we thought, okay, now we're saying something about the world, we're saying something, and that this podcast is actually jumping into almost like a tiny true crime thing, but attacking it from a funny perspective.
Yeah. Sklar Brothers with me. They are going to be at North Bar coming up on Friday, both doing two stand-up shows and a live taping of Dumb People Town, which we were just talking about. It's interesting, too, because you've carved out an angle and a niche with sports. Sports and comedy has been an area that there's always been sports podcasts, there's always been comedy podcasts, but you guys have made your name in being able to cross over and talk about the comedy of sports or the sports of comedy.
Yeah, there's a lot to be made with that as well. Yeah, I mean, we've always had the attitude that sport, I think our approach to it is we would love to be, our approach to sports is, can we make sports relatable, understandable for people who don't necessarily love sports without losing sports fans also? Mm-hmm. Like last week we were watching the NFL draft, and you know, the Bears did really well. Congratulations. You guys did a good job. But, like, watching the Browns, we're like, what does this feel like?
Yeah,
you know, for us, it felt like everybody watching Jennifer Aniston try and find a husband. You look to yourself and you're like, all right, she can pick anybody, you know, like the Browns. She has the pick of whoever she wants. But we're sitting there going, how is she going to screw this up and get the wrong guy? And she did. So that's something that my wife can laugh at, and she's not a huge sports fan.
It's kind of interesting because I was thinking about the comedy is, I think of George Carlin bit where he was kind of making fun of football. And the idea that there's always been almost a wall between the artists of comedy who make it very known that they're not sports driven. They're not into sports or whatever. They're in art. They're on stage in the club. You leave the sports for the mainstream. So there is this idea that it used to not be involved with the great stand-ups, but you're seeing more and more stand-ups get clever and essentially bring sports into their act.
Well, I think what's interesting is, first of all, a lot of comedians go into comedy because they were made fun of by athletes in high school, and they're like, well, we're going to make fun of you back. And the other thing is that most athletes are not funny. Like, the idea of humor around most athletes is pretty pedestrian, it's pretty sophomoric, and it's not very, like, anytime you see an athlete that actually has, like, an evolved sense of humor, we're all, like, blown away because it's so rare. And I think the comedy around sports has kind of been the same. It kind of caters to the lowest common denominator, and I think that's why a lot of comedians just stay away from sports. But we do feel like there is an audience of people who are smart, who love sports, but at the same time want to see it taken down a peg and the parts of it that need to be addressed. And that's what we do in our other podcast, View from the Cheap Seats, but it's what we did on our old TV show, Cheap Seats, on the ESPN Classic, and it's sort of become like a little part of our comedic brand.
The other part, too, as you mentioned with what you guys are doing on Friday with Dumb People Town, is politics. Clarkson Stripes is the you guys have been going around the country performing in both red states and blue states and kind of talking to your audiences, but also having this opportunity to do jokes and get to know the people in this country. This is something for Amazon. Talk about how this came about and getting out of sports necessarily and getting into politics.
Jane and I are, you know, we like to think that we're thoughtful people, and, you know, we go around and do stand-up, and we'll go into a town. You're there for a weekend. We're away from our families, which is hard. We each have kids, and it's hard to be away, and the attitude is, well, do we sit around the hotel all day long and then go to the shows at night, or do we go and try and experience as much as we can in these cities and maybe write some material about what we're experiencing? We thought that would be a great thing to document. So we said, okay, let's do this. 10 cities. Each city is a chapter. Each chapter is about 30 minutes long, and the plane lands on Thursday, and we give ourselves a challenge. Can we write 10 minutes of material about this town in 3 days? Sometimes we're going to, like, comedy festivals, and that's just Friday and Saturday, so you only have 2 days. You get there Friday evening, so you really only have a day and a half, and it is a huge challenge, but you hear us try and go through the process of, so it's like three documentaries in one. It's what it's like to be in this country right now in these cities, what it's like to be stand-ups going around at our level, touring around and basically doing what we do a year in the life of stand-up, and then how does an idea, an observation turn into a funny idea, which turns into a funny joke, which ultimately turns into a bit on stage. And then the first weekend we did it was the weekend after the election in 2016. We were in San Diego, which was a city that was super divided. And we realized, oh my God, as we do this over the next year, this country has never felt more divided. Everyone has retreated to their bubbles. But as comedians, you get the offer. You got to go to a super liberal city. If you're a conservative comedian, that's a challenge. If you go to a conservative city, a red city in a red state, and you're a blue comedian, you got to deal with that and without alienating your audience, but you still want to get your opinions out and your views out. So it becomes like a very interesting study in how we bring people together with comedy and while still staying true to ourselves. And we pitched that to Audible and they loved it. And they're like, this would be a great audio documentary. And so it's available on Audible called Sklars and Stripes. And we've worked on things before, but to work on something for 13 months and then have it all come together the way we intended it to is like super special. Well, I mean, what's crazy is that the guy who produced it with us, so the guy who's in the field with us producing it as we're going along, helping us
interviewing people,
you hear his voice all throughout it, is Scott Rogowski, who is the host of HQ Trivia, that crazy trivia game. So he kind of blew up in this whole year for himself, and we're just happy that everybody in the world can see how funny we know he is.
It's amazing. I mean, there's so many great projects that you guys are involved in. Sklars and Stripes on Audible, the Dumb People Town podcast, and Views from the Cheap Seats. Seats, both podcasts done by the Sklar Brothers. This Friday night, they're going to be at North Bar in Wicker Park. They're going to be doing two stand-up shows and a live taping of Dumb People Town with Dave Pasquese, which is awesome. And also, you can get their special, which will be on Stars this week. A lot going on. Jason, Randy, Sklar, I can't thank you guys enough for taking some time out to talk with me tonight on The Download. Appreciate it.
Love it. Thank you so much, and keep doing the great work that you do.
It's always about the voice, man. You got to get the right voice.
It's in the right mood.
Yep, exactly. Pooja Mohindruk joins us coming up after the 9:30 news. She's got a new web series called Gita's Guide to Moving On. It's about it's a comedy that she's created. She stars in. She is a Chicagoan who moved out to L.A. and is an actor. You can see her in a lot of different things. And she is back with this web series. She shot it here. It's really about a breakup she went through, this character went through, and how her Indian family deals with it. It's funny. There's a great scene at the beginning where she, in the first one, where they go to divorce support group because she's went there because she's getting over the breakup, and everyone's there by themselves, of course, and then maybe there's a couple or whatever, and then behind her is her whole Indian family, aunties, parents, brothers, sisters, 14 people. It's a funny look at breaking up Indian. That's how we look at it. Pooja Mohindruk will be my guest coming up after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the creator and star of the new web series, Gita's Guide to Moving On. Pooja Mohindruk plays Gita Gidwani in the comedy about moving in and, of course, moving on.
I'm Gita Gidwani.
Hi, Gita. Hi, Gita.
And I'm not divorced.
Someone's at stage one.
Denial.
I am Neelam, her mother. I brought her here because I'm a concerned parent. Agonize over my child. I know what she's going through is devastating. Come on. I know. I keep up with the Kardashian. This is her father, Jagdish.
Just call me Jack.
This is my son, Rohan. This is my daughter, Sabrina. And our son-in-law, Ted. And these are her aunties.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
We have a really big family.
We are not related.
In our culture, we call all elders uncles and aunties.
We are here just to help.
Don't worry, Gita. This is all completely confidential.
What? I'm light-tweeting this mess.
Gita's Guide to Moving On tackles the emotion that goes into a breakup and dealing with the breakup if you're from a large traditional Indian family. The series was just released on Open TV, the same platform that released the wildly successful Brown Girls, which subsequently was picked up by HBO. Pooja Mohindruk is an actor and writer who grew up right here in Chicago. And for some, the character of Gita is familiar, as she was featured in Mohindra's solo play, A Great Dive, back in 2015, put on by Silk Road Rising. In studio tonight, Pooja Mohindruk. Pooja, thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
I love it. I've seen three of the episodes, and of course, it's out. All of them are out now. And you can find them on YouTube as well. It's not just on Open TV. But talk about Gita, because this really does come from the play that you did a couple years back.
Yes, and the play came from my personal experience. So basically, I used to live in Los Angeles a couple years ago, and I was going through a pretty devastating but life transformative breakup, and I came home to Chicago for summer basically and moved in with my Indian parents and kind of wanted to recover from the breakup, and wackiness ensued. So at the time it was kind of just dealing with the breakup, but hindsight is 20/20. Years later, as I kind of moved on, I was able to see the comedy in the tragedy and the light in the dark and the beauty in the messiness of life.
How autobiographical is Gita? To have the experiences in this Gita's Guide to Moving On, but also in the play, The Great A Great Dive, how much of it do you draw from personal experiences for that character?
In the web series, I would say that it's definitely fictionalized. It's inspired and drawn from personal experience, but the show and the series are fictional experiences. So in episode 5, Gita goes on a first date, which she kind of navigates dating after 10 years of being out of the dating scene, and that date kind of goes wrong. So that, you know, that date never happened, but it's fictionalized. And then I would say the people, the characters that you see are very much drawn from my Indian American community in the Southwest suburbs and kind of these Indian aunties that are very much, we're not related, but they are part of our, you know, our elders we call aunties and uncles. And we all are a big family and very much involved, a little bit a la my big fat Greek wedding.
Right.
And so that was drawn from, that feels very true and feels like new people that we haven't really seen a lot of in mainstream television or media, but in this show, they are kind of the heroes of their story.
It's really funny. A great scene in the first episode where you go to the divorce support group. And everyone is either by themselves, anyone is there, the strangers that are in the room, or with maybe their significant other, they're working through things. And with you, you have your entire family with you.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is when we first wrote the pilot, it was very much around the family and Geeta. And I just felt like that's not my life. My life is these two worlds. They're East and West, and there's a duality to them, and sometimes they conflict, and sometimes they collide, and sometimes they come together and blend together. But our world, you know, America is this duality and a blend of all these ideas and cultures coming together. So that was why it was really important for me in the pilot for the family to be coming and interrupting into this divorce support group. And you kind of see this very American part of her world and the right. very Indian part of her world.
There is something great about your work, not only in here, but just reading about the play, that East-West duality is a big part of how you write. Where do you think that comes from? You grew up in Chicago. Talk about what it means to write about both who you are and where you came from.
Well, so basically when I was writing A Great Dive, which grew in kind of Akita's Guide to Moving On, kind of grew from that, evolved from that, I was writing about growing up in Chicago. So growing up in Chicago, I didn't know that, oh, it's East and West. It's just my house.
Right, right.
So it's like it started by doing these living room readings where I was like, I'm going to get some feedback on the show. We'd do them in living rooms in Chicago, did them in LA, got feedback. And that was when other people, audiences, taught me about my story, which I didn't realize that, oh, there's these Indian elements. I didn't realize that part of the reason the parents don't understand the breakup is because they had an arranged marriage. They never have gone through a breakup, so they don't know what that feels like.
Right, and emotion that's, there, yeah.
Exactly. So I think audiences taught me what is universal about the story and what is kind of culturally specific. But what I think is all American is this household, you know, being East and West. That is my experience of America, and I feel like for me, I feel like the show kind of redefines what it is to be all American in that way.
That's so interesting, too, because you think about you as a performer and as a writer, and a lot of what you attempt to do in entertainment, whether it be here or in Hollywood, I would assume that you put it out there, and audience feedback is there or it's not there, but how surprising was it for you to have audiences actually inform your work or to give advice or to change the work that you had put in front of it?
I love that. I am a theater kid. I went to school for theater. This web series kind of happened because I felt like it was an opportunity where I didn't have to wait for permission to tell a story. I went to school for journalism, so it's like storytelling is something that I'm so passionate about. But I just have told a story, and audiences, having the opportunity to connect with audiences is how the story grew. So, for example, the aunties, they are just my aunties. I'm just kind of telling the story of what is, but having audiences say, oh, we have those aunties. The amount of kind of Jewish, I didn't know that those aunties are in Jewish communities. They're in African-American communities. They're in many.
It's relatable across culture.
Yes,
right.
I've had Mexican-Americans tell me, oh my God, we have aunties like that. My grandma is like that. And really, really, really realizing that the common human experience, it reveals our common humanity. We're more alike and we're more connected than it may appear.
Yeah. We all have aunties.
We all have aunties. Our mothers, the women in our lives, tend to be the anchors of our homes and families. They tend to be the people that bring people together, that are kind of the leaders and organizers behind the scenes. And so I think that when you're kind of in your own story, you're not able to see it.
Yeah.
It takes an audience to complete a story, and your audiences teach you what the story is and how it can get better.
Pooja Mohindra is in studio with me. She is the creator and star of the new web series, Geeta's Guide to Moving On, which is available both on Open TV and on YouTube. Just came out. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a quick break. Pooja Mohindra back in studio, so stay with us. Boom, boom, boom. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Pooja Mohindra is in studio with me. She is the star and creator of Geeta's Guide to Moving On, a new comedy web series, which is both available on Open TV and on YouTube. You mentioned in the earlier segment just this idea of not getting permission, and that seems to be where a lot of writers and creators and entertainers are going. They just go do your own thing. You don't have to go in and pitch everybody anymore because you can go and actually use this as your pitch. How did you get to the point of doing a web series?
Yeah, so I want to also touch on the thing about the audience's feedback, mm-hmm. because what was really helpful about having audiences teach me about the story is they were able to show me what is universal about the story. The ideas of love, loss, moving on, letting go, embracing happiness, family, home, parents. That, to me, is what I was able to integrate more as we went on through audience feedback. As far as not having permission, not waiting.
Yeah, right.
As far as not waiting for permission, you know, I went to school for theater and I graduated, thought that I would do things a traditional way, audition for pilots, test, wait to be booked on a series. And I think it never occurred to me in school that this place where a brown girl is a hero of her own story mm-hmm. wasn't there.
Right.
Our drama school, we did non-traditional casting. So I, you know, was in all classical plays playing whatever role, but no one said, oh, you can't do this because you're this color or this is your name. So when I kind of got to LA and was auditioning for projects, everything changed. The rules are different. And so it kind of, I did things very traditionally the first couple years. And then I was definitely doing the working actor thing, but I felt as an artist that I wasn't working at my full potential. So I thought, okay, I will try this actually the Issa Rae way, because I basically kind of connected with her in Los Angeles and I saw her create Awkward Black Girl. I was a mm-hmm. huge fan of the show. Right. And then we kind of were in this writers, creator circle. It was called We Are the Web. It was all actors. It was all writer creators of color, basically trying to tell their own story. And she really empowered me. She taught me to think outside of the box, to dive in, to take risks, and basically create my own work. That's how it started.
And, you know, there's both that and which turned into Insecure, which is on HBO, but also Brown Girls, which is also a web series from here in Chicago. We've had the creators on the program.
Oh, I love them.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
But it's interesting because it does seem that there are more and more open doors for women of color going this route. We're seeing a lot of the shows that are getting picked up or getting an opportunity to be on places like HBO or Netflix or other places. There seems to be an audience for it, or at least a market for it. Do you see that?
Definitely. So I should clarify. I mean, when I first graduated school, there were less of those opportunities. There are definitely much more opportunities now. And I really think that TV and film is doing a great job of encouraging inclusion and diversity. And, you know, some people may argue with me that we have a longer ways to go. That's up to everyone's opinion. But I do think that this is a really exciting time to be a storyteller. Basically, anyone has access to a camera and has access to tell their story. And nobody is stopping anyone from throwing it up online. So that's super exciting. And I think that the beauty of YouTube, and I'm not really a data person, but the beauty of YouTube is you do get data, yeah. and you do get audience feedback. You get comments, you got numbers, so it is helpful to everyone to say, oh, this is resonating for people. Maybe it has the opportunity to have a longer life or widen its audience by transitioning to an HBO or whatever, you know, whatever place at home it may be.
You have two different roles in Hollywood with this, because obviously as a creator, to be able to put to be a storyteller in what you want to do and to be able to go straight to digital platforms like YouTube or even Open TV and be able to tell your story. But on the flip side, you're also an actor who gets called for auditions. Do you see a change in the way that Hollywood is approaching women of color? Are you getting called for different roles or other opportunities that may be different than when you first started out that might have been more stereotypical?
Yes, and that starts with writers, that having more writers of color in the room, people that can, and that even goes for women, right? Like even just women's stories being out there more because the writer is in the room to pitch that story as an idea, to tell that story and give it authenticity and depth so it can be brought into that television episode. I would say, yeah, I am, but it's still Geeta's Guide to Moving On. I haven't yet seen a story quite like that on network TV.
Right, right.
So I would say where I've kind of concluded is that it takes people to share their story, to share it with a wider audience. So I wouldn't expect someone who is a Mexican-American guy to tell my story.
Right, right,
I should take accountability for that. And also, I don't believe that I should be self-indulgent. It's not about my story. It's about helping others, connecting with an audience. So what is it about this story that is relevant to all of us? Because, no, who cares about Pooja's story? Not interesting. But what I ask is, why does this matter to somebody else?
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, talking about the universality of it, this idea that it might be traditional Indian-American family, but there are a lot of universal elements. An African-American family, a Mexican-American family can relate to the aunties like we talked about. And it makes me think about today, and I've had people on talking about this at different points, talking about even Master of None and Aziz Ansari or Mindy Kaling, and this idea that the Indian-American story is being told in America. And finally, we're getting more of an Americanized story as opposed to imports from India, Bollywood, and others. Do you see it that way? Do you see that more people are becoming familiar and comfortable with the story of an Indian-American family or an Indian-American lead telling her story about her experience?
I think what they're doing is really exciting because they are showing that the South Asian story or the Indian-American story is an American story. So I think what's exciting about the work that they're doing is, so when we look at Aziz Ansari, we see a brown man, but we see a man's challenges with modern dating, with modern love, technology and dating. And so that to me is exciting because it's really something that we're all dealing with in 2018.
Right back to that.
With Geeta's Guide to Moving On, it's like, okay, yes, that's a brown girl's story of her, love and loss and moving on. But the first line of our pilot is loss is inevitable. People die. Relationships die. It is fundamental to the human experience that everyone, whether you're rich, poor, young, old, brown, white, purple, everyone is going to be faced with loss and heartache at one moment in time in their lives. And what do you do with that? How do you let go? How do you embrace happiness is at the core of this web series. And it's something that we all have to come to our own answers about.
As you look to the future, now that this is out, do you see yourself doing season 2, season 3? Do you see this as a calling card? Do you take it with you to your Hollywood connections? I mean, what is the future for you and Geeta's Guide?
I would love to do another season. I have loved showcasing. One of my favorite parts about working on this is making it in Chicago. We shot the whole series in Chicago. We went to Pilsen. We went to River North. We shot in Westridge. We shot in dive restaurants on the L. I think it totally showcases Chicago. And I would say right now what we're doing is adapting it into a pilot. And yeah, we would love to shop it around, see what the response is. Right. That is to come and hopefully the next step. And
it's a whole different world. Just being in Hollywood, it used to be that you would have to go and say, now picture this. Right? That's what you have to do for the pitch. But now you're in a situation where you can send a link and say, we've already produced these things.
It is so exciting. I feel so grateful to be a storyteller in this moment in time. And I encourage anyone who's listening to go for it. There's nothing stopping you. And we have the opportunity to connect with our audiences. And if somebody says no, so what? You still have your camera on YouTube.
That's right.
So go for it.
The web series is called Geeta's Guide to Moving On. It's both on Open TV and on YouTube. It follows the character of Geeta Gidwani. It's a show about moving in and moving on. Pooja Mohindra is the creator and star, and she is in studio tonight. Pooja, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in, and good luck with everything. We look forward to seeing you on the big screen.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. It is time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, it's the first warm night of the year. It's the Michigan Avenue Strollers. They're in for a treat. Chicago hip-hop artist Mello Makes Music is here. He just put out a new single, which is getting all sorts of serious play, called Smoke and Mirrors. He set himself apart from the pack by bringing together all sorts of genres to create a very unique sound. Mello hails from the South Side, and he's put out a steady stream of singles for the last couple of years. He does have new music on the way, and he's going to be doing a release party coming up at Juggernaut on the South Loop on Wednesday. You got an RSVP to go. You find that info at his Facebook page. Mello Makes Music in Studio 435 tonight. Here he is with Van Isaacson on the guitar. Here's the song Love at the Brink. Take it away, Mello. ¶¶
I might end my rebel soon, begin my descent then. Like I don't know nothing, ignore my resentment. Hey, hey, young and ruthless, I was toothless at my grandma's house. Hey, for I grew up and went through stuff wearing hand-me-downs. Hey, hey, play your hand, you was bluffing, but it don't matter now. Next day we made up, got to stuffing on your best friend couch. Hey, she too caught up on tootsies following me, as if it's fame and attention that I seek. Nah, it, at first sight I knew it was love at the brink. Expedite my reprieve, cause nothing is what it seems. Mama raised me a soldier, said I break a heart but I can never hold one. Yeah, I'm not the boy you picture on your poster. So up and down like we some roller coasters. I didn't want to take it too fast. Accelerate and the brick will place my foot on the gas. Hated fate, can we make it? Can we make this last? Play your card, play your hand. I say bet it up, now bet it up. We are is ever changing. We aren't is such a strange thing. All reaching for the same things. We aren't is. I say bet it up, now bet it up. Hey, young and ruthless, I was toothless at my grandma's house. Hey, for I grew up and went through stuff wearing hand-me-downs. Hey, young and dumb was me and you when we first messed around. Still when we broke up, you got choked up on your best friend couch. I know I messed around. That's why you peep my phone like, what's that text about? Realty though, maybe I got an ego. She say I'm aggressive, I blame it on my libido. I can't stand watching myself in the third person. I can't close curtains, but players is still acting. Passed out, overdose, so blame it on the music. Bet it up, better off than right back to my pool. Hey, young and ruthless, I went through it, check my bank account. She too caught up on tootsies following me, as if it's fame and attention that I seek. Nah, and at first sight I knew it was love at the brink. I might end my rebel soon, begin my descent then. Like I don't know nothing, ignore my resentment.
Yeah, how about that? Mellow Mix Music in studio. 4:35 tonight, Chicago hip-hop artist from Southside is here. He's got a show coming up at Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday. You got RSVP to go. Of course, you can find his info at his Facebook page, Mellow Makes Music. He's in studio 4:35 tonight. That song was called Love at the Brink, and also on guitar, Van Isaacson. Mellow, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me.
So this is great. I mean, I said at the beginning that one of your strengths and what makes your music so... I just think so mesmerizing is the fact that you can blend so many different genres. That's a great example of if people hear hip-hop artists, they don't necessarily think of that as a hip-hop song. Talk about where that comes from, the idea that your music is a blend of genre.
Yeah, that's a great question. I kind of think it just comes from growing up with a very eclectic kind of palette and like source for music. My mom, she has just like a crazy catalog, and she had all these CDs growing up, so I was just exposed to so much. So it kind of naturally took shape.
It's funny because I was reading an article today about you, and they talked about a couple of bands that it was a steady stream of Cure and Nine Inch Nails.
Oh yeah, yeah, lots of the Cure. And it's so funny that it's Nine Inch Nails because I actually don't listen to them much these days. But that kind of led into like my Nirvana obsession growing up. Another band my mom put me onto.
That's interesting because a lot of that music, you know, especially you talk about The Cure and Nine Inch Nails, you don't necessarily connect with hip hop. How do you How do you use the inspiration to be able to create the kind of sound to fit into the genre that you're performing in?
It's interesting. I feel like. It's strange, like the feelings of hip hop kind of always felt very synonymous with that of like punk rock and roll. So like even though sonically there's not much in common, like there's something about the emotion and the raw emotion that I connected to it, like for starters, yeah, right. When I first started out. So I feel like that's kind of what, you know, brought those two genres together in my head. And now, like, I can't even go to make a song without, you know what I'm saying, like, belting out a few times or just getting that, you know, that emotional distress on the track.
So it's the emotion. It's not necessarily what category you fit in, but it's the emotion, the passion you put into it, right?
Yeah, well, I feel like there's always something to, like, express there. And, you know, people always say, like, you know, you're trying to get let off some steam, scream into a pillow. So I just scream into the microphone. But yeah, and I have a huge appreciation for hip hop and the craft of rapping and stuff like that. So, I feel like that's kind of like where the blend came from. It's just like, you know, my love for all those genres and then also just my need to express myself in such a way.
Where's it come from? I mean, I also read that when you were 11, 12 years old, you got a keyboard and you started working on keys. So talk about where the music comes from in your family.
That's actually interesting, too, because no one in my family prior to me really dabbled into music too much. It was actually my little sister who introduced the idea for me at the age of, around like 12. I was like 11 or 12. She had like a little toy keyboard and she was playing Fur Elise on it. And I was so impressed and I was like, I can't let her outdo me. It's like that sibling, like
it became like a sibling competition, right?
That competitiveness between us siblings. So I got my own toy keyboard and started teaching myself a lot of Beethoven's classics just on one hand. And then that kind of evolved to my dad getting me a Casio when I was 13 or so. And then I started teaching myself from there. And then I taught myself guitar from piano. And then I kind of took a break from music for a couple years. It wasn't until I got into college that I picked it back up as a hobby. And then I saw that I could like probably do something with this.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who might be listening right now are like, oh, that sounds like me. At a certain point, you dabble in music, maybe you learn an instrument, you get into college, it becomes a hobby. But there's a big difference between, you know, like that sounds a lot like me in the way that I will learn an instrument and say I want to be a musician and actually being a musician. What is it that takes you from the hobby level to what you're doing now as Mello?
There's so many, I feel like there was, you know, so many factors and like kind of like a domino effect of things that happened that led me to this seat right here. But I guess it was just the idea that I wanted to do something with my life that I felt, you know, really, you know, sure and like happy about, something that I would like wake up and be like, yeah, I'm glad I made that decision. And even though it's hard work, I'm glad that, you know, I'm sticking with this because, you know, I'm truly happy, you know, doing this. It's just like an occupational thing.
Right.
But it wasn't until I saw artists like Chance the Rapper and, you know, Saba, a couple other independent artists from the city come up and start doing this that I realized, yeah, this is a viable career option.
Yeah, so stuff like that. I loved hearing that because, you know, even 10 years ago, the idea of being a musician was met with, okay, you have to sort of follow a career path that has already been set out. If you want to be a musician, you have to go here, you got to start playing shows, you got to have a following, you have to get the record industry to pay attention to you and maybe put out a record. Like all that that we all know is out the window now.
Right.
Does that make it easier to be a musician or harder?
I feel like both, like yes to both, like both statements. It is easier and harder to be a musician these days. You know, the beautiful thing is the internet. Anybody who has, you know, an idea, they can get it out there. And that's what basically has changed the music industry in a major way. However, now there's more competition.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's a bigger pond now. So you're still a little fish in an even bigger pond. But, you know, the possibilities of, you know, rubbing shoulders with somebody on the internet who can make this one song blow up, you know, it's just those chances are higher these days. So it's kind of weird to gauge what exactly, like, if it's harder now, I'm not sure. I feel like to some degree it's easier, and then at the same time it is hard. It's
Mello Makes Music is in studio, hip-hop artist. His latest single just came out, Smoke and Mirrors, which you can find on SoundCloud, iTunes, all over the place. He's got a show coming up at Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday. It's a pop-up. You have to RSVP to go.
Yes.
The info is at his Facebook page, Mello Makes Music. He's my guest tonight at Studio 435. We'll hear some more live music coming up here with Mello Makes Music. Stay with us. Mello Makes Music in Studio 435 tonight. Chicago hip-hop artist just put out a new single called Smoke and Mirrors. He's going to be celebrating that single and other stuff at the Juggernaut on South Loop on Wednesday. It's a pop-up show. You got to RSVP to go. Find the info at his Facebook page. Mello, what's that mean? What's a pop-up show for those who are listening?
So basically, it's going to be like a whole experience. So we're going to have some pieces of merchandise that I made for the tour that I just got off of with Taylor Bennett.
Love Taylor. Taylor is a big part of the show.
He's one of my close friends.
He came on and did a live show. Love that kid.
Yeah, he's awesome. Yeah, he's awesome. Tour was great. Love to talk about that in a bit too.
Yeah.
But we're gonna be selling some shirts. There's gonna be some drinks, you know what I'm saying? Obviously if you're 21. and then also some unreleased music from my mixtape that I'm dropping on Friday, actually, May 4th.
And so it's just a party.
Yeah.
Why do they call it a pop-up? Because it just takes over the store?
I think just because, I'm taking over the store and just throwing some shirts up there just for that one night. Right. So, we're just popping up in there. And then we're out of there at 7.
How much of it, is in your career, is it just about the music? Or how much of it is about the culture?
I feel like it's always about the culture, but at the same time, the music is driving the culture. So they kind of feel synonymous, in that. I just feel like it's one thing, honestly.
For you, I've always, listening to your stuff today, it was fascinating because you have put out single after single after single, but not in the way that I see a lot of other hip hop artists will drop a mixtape and do 12 tracks at once, or they'll do an album. Mm. Or even an EP.
Right.
In your career, you've seen single after single after single after single. Still a tremendous amount of material that's been released, but why do you release it that way? Why do you release it single only?
That's an interesting question. For a while, it was a strategy just to kind of sparsely release singles and kind of, build momentum that way, kind of be like this mysterious force in the music scene until, it was just kind of like I got like this undeniable need to drop a project. But I think nowadays, kind of piggybacking on what we were talking about as far as the internet goes and what changes that's made to music is, we have short attention spans as people in this day and age. So I think it's time for me to drop a bigger body of work. So I'm actually doing that this Friday, like I said.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. Just get the reactions off of that.
Absolutely.
And Smoke and Mirrors will be on that.
All right.
Well.
Good. Mello Makes Music in Studio 435 tonight. So we've also got Van Isaacson on guitar. What are we going to hear here?
Freaky Friday.
Freaky Friday. All right. This is the track Freaky Friday. Mello Makes Music. We'll be at the Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday. You have to RSVP to go, so just go to his Facebook page to do so. Mello Makes Music. Here is the track Freaky Friday, Studio 435. Take it away, guys.
I know you hate me a little, I don't blame you. If I was you, I would hate me, cause from your perspective, I think you crazy. If I was you, I would be shady too. Hit you on the daily too. We both stop doing what we said we do. If I was you, I would stop giving it up. Ignore all my calls and stop hitting me up. I like being myself more than being in love. Baby girl, if I was you, I be more cautious, I begin cutting my losses. Sleep when I'm feeling exhausted, instead of staying up deep in the internet, hoping you see me do what you imagine it. I would see jumping into conclusions, wouldn't look at who liking your selfies, rid myself from eternal confusion, but run out of reasons to accuse you. Find my power to stop this from happening, draw the line between hurt and abuse. Nah, I wouldn't, if I was you. I know you hate me a little, I don't blame you. If I was you, I would hate me a little. Don't like feeling used, no, you hate feeling little. I know you hate me a little, it's okay, dear. Spend so much time, if you was me. You see all the stuff on my plate, you see how been stuck in his ways. You know I'm too stubborn to divvy the weight and to give you away. Can't forget how you play. You know I know you like to cheat. If you was me, you would stop giving it up. Ignore all my calls and stop. Baby girl, if I was you, I know you hate me a little. I don't blame you. If I was you, I would hate me a little. Don't like feeling used, no, you hate feeling little. I know you hate me a little. It's okay, dear.
If you was me, you would hate me a little. Spent so much time feeling caught in the middle.
Yeah, Mellow Makes Music in Studio 435 tonight. That's great, man. That's the track Freaky Friday. Well, that Freaky Friday will be on the new stuff coming up on Friday.
It will be. Yeah. Freaky Friday will be available on Friday.
All right, new music coming out Friday. This is great. You heard it here first, or not, maybe you heard it here
actually
first. Yeah?
Yeah.
We can claim the exclusive?
You can claim the exclusive. I did perform it on tour, but... You know, those people very short glimpse.
There you go. There you go. Mellow Makes Music in Studio 435 tonight. You can see him at Juggernaut at the South Loop on Wednesday. You got an RSVP to go to that show. Find the info at his Facebook page. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back more live performance here in Studio 435. So stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN in Studio 435, our weekly segment here on Monday nights where we present the best live music Chicago has to offer in our beautiful Michigan Avenue Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase Studio. Tonight, Mellow Makes Music is here. Mellow is a Chicago hip-hop artist from the south side of Chicago who has put out a single, Smoke and Mirrors, and the full project is coming out this Friday. The single is out right now. You can find it everywhere, and he has got a show at Juggernaut in the South Loop coming up on Wednesday. You got an RSVP to go, so the best place to do that would be through the Mellow Makes Music Facebook page. Just type that in, and you're good to go. In studio, he's got one more song to play. Before we do that, let's talk a little bit more. I'm always fascinated about Chicago hip-hop right now. You kind of mentioned Chance and Taylor as well. You went on tour. When you're on tour and you guys are from Chicago, and you guys are going out and do that, does that mean more today than it did 5 years ago?
I mean, I honestly wouldn't know, you know, how to compare it exactly, but it is cool to be able to go out on tour with you know, just all the guys from Chicago and just represent the city as a group of musicians, rather than just it be me and I'm sure they probably feel the same way too.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely cool.
I just wonder because there will be so many fame stories, and Chicago has those stories too, but I think of Los Angeles and even New York of scenes that develop, right? Mm. Where you have I read the Motley Crue book, and Motley Crue has the Dirt, which is one of the greatest books. If you've not read it, you should read it. They tell their own story. But in the beginning, when they were all trying to be the hair metal bands of the 80s, every one of those guys lived together. They hung out together. Mm. They were at the one club together off of Sunset Boulevard. Mm. But you couldn't, they were all interchangeable, meaning they were all in the bands. They all support each other. They all went to their same shows. Their goal was for their whole movement, their whole scene to make it. Is it like that way in hip hop in Chicago?
I want to say that, you know, a lot of us are trying to get it that way, or kind of move in a direction to where we could say that, you know, we really helped each other, you know, achieve some success and some status. I think a city that, you know, not to throw Chicago under the bus, because this is my hometown and I love it to pieces, but I think, you know, hip hop in Atlanta is really where you see that kind of community, and you see the artists there like really support and hug each other. And you know, I feel like a lot of artists see that happening in Atlanta and are inspired to do the same here. But you know what I'm saying? That's just something we'll see, you know, in the future, hopefully. And I think that with every new artist that pops up every day in the city, you know what I'm saying? Feeling like that, or like feeling like how the guys do in Atlanta, will definitely benefit, you know, the whole scene in the future.
Yeah, I just wonder about that, because Chicago is such a big town. And when people say Chicago hip-hop, they automatically assume that every artist who is under the umbrella of hip-hop in Chicago knows each other.
Right.
But there are a lot of different scenes, and there are a lot of different artists that are all trying to make it. Do you see a lot of crossover from, say, the conscious rap, or even the stuff that you're doing, which I guess would be classified more like alternative, and say the more the drill stuff, or maybe the mainstream stuff that's kind of being produced here?
I feel like there is a little bit more of a divide between kind of like the drill music in Chicago and then like all the other kinds of music happening in Chicago, which is something that, you know, I personally, you know, I'd love to see those barriers and those divisions kind of erased a little bit more. And I think the media does it more than anything, because, you know, a lot of people actually have known each other for years, you know what I'm saying, just growing up in the city.
Right, right.
Or going to After School Matters or Gallery 37, like different public like programs that a lot of us kind of were in and out of when we were younger. So I don't know. I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people in music and the city kind of noticed as well. So it's interesting. Like, we'll see how that plays out. Also,
I hear I've had a lot of artists in this studio talk about Gallery 37, talk about After School Matters and the after school programs, the arts programs that the city offers for city students, for city public school students.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because, you know, everyone from huge success stories like Chance or Jeremiah was on the show talking about being in After School Matters. Like, it's something that Gallery 37. How important is that kind of thing? These moments, these after school programs, things that people just kind of throw away to an artistic community.
So important. You know, more than words can even explain right now. But you know, giving kids, especially, you know, kids from the South Side, or, you know, kids who are just not growing up in the healthiest of environments, giving them something to do after school that's, you know, conducive is super important. And, you know, I think that's why After School Matters still stands, you know, to this day. But, you know, I haven't been there in a while, but when I was there, the staff was great. They treated the kids really well, you know, gave us, you know, a huge opportunity to, you know, feel like the artist that we wanted to be, you know, very prematurely. And there I did screen printing, which is something completely different than what I do now. But they gave me a chance to really, you know, like really flesh out that craft. And I spent a couple of years there, and now they throw that thing at the cultural center. I don't know if they still do that, but they do it at the end of every summer session, and they give the kids a chance to, you know, showcase their work and really, you know, have an event that's like tailored around, you know, all this work you've been doing all summer. It's just a real quick and easy way to empower, you know, the youth. So I think, I basically think things like that, are very important in the city. I'd love to see more different like infrastructures like that pop up, but we'll see. I think Melody Lucas used to run it. I don't think she does anymore.
Yeah,
that's George Lucas's wife. Yeah, right. For anybody who doesn't know. We were all super geeking out about that.
I was gonna say, yeah, you got all the elite names for us. But okay, I'm another thing that always gets mentioned, and I love this through line about one of the other things that the after school programs do is that it brings a lot of kids together from different backgrounds, different parts of the city, in a way that's also what the high school system in Chicago does, because you don't necessarily go to high school next to where you live. It means you have to take trains and buses and other places, and that can be a pain in the ass when it's happening.
Right.
But you start to meet new people, other like-minded students, and you also experience different cultures. Mm. Is it similar in your when you think about your experience at After School Matters and,
100%.
And how it affects you as an artist and a musician today?
Yeah. I mean, I made a lot of my friends that went to other schools because of After School Matters, which I thought was, like, you know, super important just to get that, you know, diversity. And like, there's so much different culture in different neighborhoods in Chicago. It's so interesting. You know, some people say that it's one of the, like, it's a super liberal city, but it's a super segregated city. And I kind of stand by those words a little bit, because you can kind of, you know, tell when there's kids from, you know, who go to Lane Tuck versus the kids who went to De La Salle or wherever you are in the city. So After School Matters kind of just broke all those bridges down, and you're just in one building, you know, every day or every weekend or whatever it is. So yeah, it was definitely a cool opportunity to meet other kids my age interested in the same things in the city. And it's funny because, like I said, a lot of those kids are the same people who I still interact with, like, you know, every weekend, going to the club or wherever, going to work on some stuff at Soho House or whatever it is. Those people are still very active in the same community, and it's just cool to see us all grow up and get older.
Mello Makes Music in studio tonight. We're talking about his career and also listening to some live music. We got another track coming up here. You could see him at Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday. Got an RSVP to go. The best place to do that is Facebook page. You got the link there. Mello Makes Music is the page. Your music, Smoke and Mirrors is a good example. When we talked at the beginning of this segment, we talked about how you mix genres. There's a lot going on. But there's a lot going on in that song. And a lot of your songs, I mean, you can really tell the production on that is much more advanced than just a normal hip-hop track. You've got a couple of vocal tracks. You've got a lot of different instrumentation. Talk about the production that goes into your music. What are you trying to accomplish? Because you are very good at blending the genres. And I mean, at one point, being able to rap, one place to sing, one to put a bass track on. I mean, there's a lot going on. Talk about the production of the music.
I think, you know, early on with the record I had called Murphy's Law, I realized, you know, at least to a very basic level, like kind of like the formula for how to, you know, pull off what I was trying to do. So I kind of... I've like fine tuned the balance so much, it's hard to even like nitpick it and like tear it apart, because it's just like I said, I put on a beat and then I'm just like doing that, you know, whatever that is, like screaming, rapping thing, whatever that thing is. But, you know, I say just going into it with that mindset that I need to get some stuff off my chest, but then also, you know, having collaborators like Van, who's right behind me, you know, introduce his violin to the song. Or play guitar on a song, stuff like that. Kind of like, you know, just takes it up a level than just, you know, using just the production that I work on with the producer. But that's, you know, that's a whole beast in and of itself, is just that production and what that producer does. You know, that's its own collaboration.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, what comes first? Does the music come first, or does the lyrics? Does the like you said, what you want to say?
It honestly depends. Lately, I've been really melody heavy, so I actually start with the melody, oftentimes with the production. Martin Sky is one of my collaborators who I do production with. He's another artist in the city, and the way we were kind of doing it for a while is, you know, he would start making the beat, and I would just sit next to him. I start humming melodies, trying to figure out what would be good for a hook. What would be good for, you know, a catchy like verse, like 4-bar melody, stuff like that. And I would just record voice memos over and over again. And then I would just like weed through those later and figure out what the hottest one was. But I would kind of like help the beat like become fleshed out with those melodies as well. So sometimes it's built from the ground up like that. Yeah, sometimes right. I get a beat in my email and I'm like, man, this is hot. So I just do my thing on it. Then I might embellish it or ask, like I said, Van to hop on, or another musician who I think could complement the track with their instrument of choice, stuff like that. So I think a lot of those elements combine to make what I like to call like a more cinematic experience when you listen to
it. That's a good way to put it, yeah.
I just want people to, you know, kind of like get into the atmosphere that I'm trying to set, basically the scene I'm trying to set.
Yeah, it's very cinematic. That's a good way to describe your music.
Yeah.
Mellow Makes Music is my guest tonight, Studio 435. He's got a new single out right now, which you can find on iTunes, SoundCloud, all the places, Spotify. Smoke and Mirrors is the track. And Friday, new music is going to drop, which will include Smoke and Mirrors, include the music we heard tonight, Freaky Friday, as well as a show coming up on Wednesday at Juggernaut in the South Loop. It's a pop-up. You got to RSVP to go. Find the info on the Facebook page, Mellow Makes Music. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We will get one more live song in Studio 435 with Mellow Makes Music. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Studio 435, where we have the best live music Chicago has to offer every night in the Allstate Showcase Studio right here in beautiful Michigan Avenue every Monday night. It'd be awesome, Bob. Bob Ferguson does the production. If we did this every night, that'd be great, right?
Oh, yeah.
You'd love it. Chicago hip-hop artist Mellow Makes Music is here. He just put out a new single called Smoke and Mirrors. And that you can also, that music will be out. It's out right now, the single, but you can also get the full package on Friday. Mellow's going to be at Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday night. You got an RSVP to go. Go to his Facebook page, Mellow Makes Music, to get all that information. We're ready for our last track tonight. Mellow Makes Music with Van Isaacson on the guitar. Here is the song Sleepless. Take it away, guys.
I slipped and fell on the blackest ice. Was moving at the speed of light.
you still overseen, overlooked. Fool me once, can't fool me twice, though. I was like eight, trying to dance like Mike. Cirque du Soleil, now walk the tightrope. Learned to live life when it's something to die for. Now the reception, say I'm seamless. Can't take no breaks, and I see the light for. Achieving achievement, broke the seams, and the whole scene seen. They say I folks, passion to die. At the speed of light, was moving at the fool me once, came fool me twice, though. I was like, hey, trying to dance like Mike. Cirque du Soleil, now walk the tightrope. Learn the da 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 da. This ritual made it habitual. And soon I'm collecting residuals. This that original digital. Martin said send it up, but I need some love, I don't get enough. I'm just the product of growing up, look how it ended up, yeah. Ah, oh, ah, I'm finna send it up. Ah, this individual, I'm not a cynic, atypical, a dissonant. This for the dreamless, this for the ceaseless, this for the seekers. Oh, planted our seeds, this for the sleepless, yeah. This for my city, I speak for the speechless. This for my city, departed friends. This for my city, my exes who sneak. This. This for my city, my city, my city, repeat. This, fooled me once, can't fool me twice. I was like eight, trying to dance like Mike. Cirque du Soleil, now walk the tightrope. Learn da 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 da.
Yeah, all right. Mellow Makes Music live in Studio 435 tonight. You can check him at Juggernaut in the South Loop on Wednesday. Got our RSVP for that show, so find the info on his Facebook page. Also, Smoke and Mirrors is out on all the placing in SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify. New music on Friday. Mellow Makes Music, a Chicago hip-hop artist in Studio 435 tonight. Mellow, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was great. All right, coming up, Amy Guth here on 720 WGN. She's in for Patty Vasquez tonight. We will be back, I believe, on Wednesday, right? You know who's going to be our guest at the big table? This is so great. Jason Reitman, filmmaker, a big, awesome film that's out right now called Tully. It comes out this weekend. I just saw it. It's really great. Charlize Theron is the star, and Jason Reitman going to be the guest at the big table. So I'm excited for that coming up on Wednesday night. And I guess the White Sox played this week. They're coming back to, I was just about to say Comiskey, but they're coming back to Guaranteed Rate on Thursday, and there's a lot of rain in the forecast. So there's a chance that we would also have a show coming up Thursday or Friday, which we will be ready for. We know how to handle a rain delay. Took us one show, but we got there.